You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. I'd like to welcome you all to Guns and Butter. I'm here at KPFA, and of course today is a fun drive for our radio station, KPFA. I'm very pleased to bring you today some audio, some little audio from a 5-hour, 3-DVD documentary on 9/11 called September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, 12 years of public debate on 9/11. These are three DVDs produced by Italian filmmaker Massimo Mazzucco, whom I spoke on the phone with at length. Great guy. He's a wonderful filmmaker. Of course, many of you longtime Guns and Butter listeners may remember years ago we used The New American Century, his film, on a fun drive here. Incredible film. This, a brand new documentary, September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, is a 5-hour documentary that summarizes 12 years of public debate on 9/11. And that's what is different about this documentary from many others, is that it includes the history of the public debate on those events. All the most important issues in this debate are presented in full detail, showing both the positions of those who reject the official version, the 9/11 truth movement, and the positions of those who support it, called the debunkers. So stay tuned. We're going to start from the very beginning here. September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor.
On the very day of September 11, several commentators drew a parallel with the historical events of Pearl Harbor.
And it's a day that will, as was the case with Pearl Harbor, live in infamy in American history.
The last time there was an attack like this on the United States was Pearl Harbor.
Reminiscent of another terrible day, the attack on Pearl Harbor.
But there was also someone on the same day who offered a prediction.
After the attack on Pearl Harbor, guess what we did? We went back and found out that, yes, the evidence was there. We should have known. And again, I think what we're going to see, even in this instance, this Pearl Harbor of the 21st century is very much the same kind of thing.
In fact, the more information that has been emerging about September 11, the more we have come to realize that many different aspects of the two events bear a chilling resemblance to each other. Both events were needed by the U.S. to go to war. In both cases, the ultimate goal was not the one initially stated.
Roosevelt knew a surprise Japanese attack would enrage the public and jumpstart the American war machine. In this way, FDR would get backdoor entry into what he really wanted. War with Hitler.
According to their own documents, before 9/11, the neocons knew that a surprise attack, like a new Pearl Harbor, would enrage the public and jumpstart the war machine against Afghanistan. In this way, they would get a backdoor entry into what they really wanted, the war with Saddam Hussein.
From the very beginning, there was a conviction that Saddam Hussein was a bad person and that he needed to go.
He says that going after Saddam Hussein was topic A 10 days after the inauguration, 8 months before September 11th.
Before and during the war, the propaganda machine made a relentless effort to create a direct connection between Hitler and Japan.
One poll taken immediately after Pearl Harbor showed that more than 60% of Americans believed that Germany was behind the attack.
The Bush-Cheney propaganda machine made an even harder effort to create a direct association between Iraq and Osama bin Laden. By the end of 2003, nearly 70% of Americans believed that Saddam was implicated in the September 11 attacks. Top levels of the Roosevelt administration knew in advance that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked.
General Marshall and Admiral Stark, and indeed FDR, indeed knew that Pearl Harbor was being painted for a bombing run by the Japanese.
Secretary of State Cordell Hull even knew the exact day of the attack, a week before it took place.
Cordell Hull was Secretary of State. And he called me on Saturday mornings and he started to relate that Pearl Harbor would be attacked on December the 7th.
Before September 11, many in the intelligence community knew the attacks were on their way.
There was so much discussion about this attack. Everybody was talking about it. George Tenet had some meetings. Other analysts had meetings at the White House.
Vital information on the Japanese attack was kept from those who could have used it to defend the Hawaiian port and to minimize the number of American casualties.
Two men could use that information immediately. Admiral Husband Kimmel and Lieutenant General Walter Short, the commanders at Pearl Harbor. But they never get it. According to Hill, that was no mistake.
If FDR and his administration deliberately withheld the vital intelligence from Pearl Harbor, and all the evidence indicates that they did, then it was certainly a deliberate conspiracy to set Pearl Harbor up for a total defeat.
Before September 11, important information was kept from counterterrorism czar Richard Clark, who could have organized a defense and even have prevented the attacks altogether.
You have to intentionally stop it. You have to intervene and say, no, I don't want that report to go.
We therefore conclude that there was a high-level decision in the CIA ordering people not to share that information.
In both cases, the pre-knowledge by the U.S. government on the upcoming attacks was denounced in front of Congress.
In September 1944, Republican Representative Forrest Harness of Indiana made the first congressional charge about a Pearl Harbor conspiracy. He said that 3 days before Pearl Harbor, the Australian government had warned Washington that a Japanese aircraft carrier was headed towards Hawaii. But, he said, that information was withheld from Kimmel and Short.
After September 11, Republican Congressman Kurt Weldon denounced the pre-knowledge of information on the upcoming attacks, which was intentionally withheld from the intelligence community.
This is an attempt to prevent the American people from knowing the facts about how we could have prevented 9/11, and people are covering it up today.
When honest officials stumbled on important information on the Japanese attack, they went straight to their superiors, only to see that information ignored, diverted, or suppressed altogether.
The chief of naval intelligence in Washington, Captain Alan Kirk, recognized the message's plans for a bombing raid, but his persistent attempts to warn Kimmel ended when he was assigned to other duties. At Pearl Harbor, the admiral had no way of knowing that Kirk had been repeatedly refused permission to warn him.
In August 2001, FBI agent Colleen Rowley discovered information that could have led to uncover the September 11 plot. But her memos never got past her superiors, while she was prevented from pursuing the investigation any further.
Finally, it turns out they were not read by the lawyer in the FBI who had the duty to send those over to the Department of Justice.
Hours before the Japanese strike, Roosevelt's chief of staff, George Marshall, became suddenly unavailable, delaying the process of communication within the chain of command.
General George Marshall, the man who should have acted, was nowhere to be found. Colonel Rufus Bratton was responsible for keeping Marshall supplied with such vital information. For Bratton, Marshall's sudden unavailability at a time when America was on the brink of war could not have been accidental.
In the crucial hours of September 11, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld and other top military became suddenly unavailable, hampering the decisional process within the chain of command.
For 30 minutes, we couldn't find him.
Withholding information, however, may not have been sufficient to guarantee the success of the Japanese attack. The military capacity of the Hawaiian port was also kept below its requirements.
General Short, faced with the need to send out long-range patrols, had only a handful of suitable aircraft. His demands for more were not seen as a priority.
On September 11, only 4 jets remained on alert to defend the entire sector of the country most likely to suffer an attack.
I've determined, of course, that with only 4 aircraft, we cannot defend the whole northeastern United States.
President Roosevelt gave direct orders not to interfere with the Japanese attack.
President Roosevelt told General Marshall to send a message to the Hawaiian and Philippine commanders, don't interfere with Japan's overt act of war. The United States desires that Japan commit the first overt act.
There's no argument about what FDR meant. He meant that that the U.S. naval plan to defend Pearl Harbor should not and cannot be executed.
On September 11, Vice President Cheney gave a direct order regarding the plane headed towards Washington, which in fact resulted in the plane reaching its target without being shot down.
Young man said, Vice President, the plane's 10 miles out. Do the orders still stand? And the Vice President sort of whipped his head around and said, of course they do.
It was thanks to the indignation for the 3,000 sailors killed at Pearl Harbor that President Roosevelt could finally enter a war the U.S. had been preparing for months in advance.
With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God.
It was thanks to the indignation for the 3,000 victims of September 11 that President Bush could launch a war that had already been prepared in the smallest detail. CNN and Time magazine have reported that on September 10, 2001, a military plan to attack Afghanistan had been placed on George Bush's desk to be signed by the president upon his return from Florida.
May God grant us wisdom, and may he watch over the United States of America.
Then came the official commissions, which in both cases were tasked to find out whether there had been a conspiracy by the same authorities that were suspected of having participated in the conspiracy.
Just 3 months after VJ Day, Senator Alvin Barkley of Kentucky convenes the Joint Congressional Committee on the investigation of the Pearl Harbor attack. The committee lays much of the blame on the commanders at Pearl Harbor and largely exonerates FDR and his top advisors. But its conclusions draw charges of cover-up and cronyism.
Gross negligence becomes high treason when the motive is discovered or understood.
In July 2004, the commission published its final report.
2.5 million pages of documents. We've interviewed over 1,200 individuals, including experts and officials past and present.
However, the commission report failed to meet many of the family's expectations and concluded that 9/11 was merely a failure of imagination.
Published in 2004, the 9/11 commission report has become the central focus of criticism by the 9/11 Truth Movement, a movement comprised of thousands of individuals and associations from all over the world, all connected through the internet. The commission's report is accused of having simply rubber-stamped the government's version of the events by ignoring all the evidence against it while covering up its most conspicuous holes with a long series of omissions, distortions, and even plain falsehoods. Led by researcher David Ray Griffin, an international panel of 20 experts on 9/11 has compiled a list of the strongest evidence against the official version that has emerged to this day. This evidence is available to the public on their website in 4 different languages. Despite all the evidence that has emerged in the last decades, there are many who still reject the idea of a conspiracy at Pearl Harbor and prefer to reassert the much more simplistic explanation called the official version.
There was no conspiracy. FDR did not know. Cordell Hull did not know. The American government did not know that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. It was what has been called a failure of imagination.
Despite all the evidence presented in the last 10 years by the 9/11 Truth Movement, there are many who openly support the official version by the government and dismiss such evidence as irrelevant. These people are known as debunkers, as their stated intent is to debunk the evidence presented by the 9/11 Truth Movement against the official version. The most authoritative debunker in Italy is Paolo Attivissimo, a member of an organization called CICAP, which has openly declared war on the so-called conspiracy theorists. Attivissimo has held numerous conferences on 9/11 in which he has covered all the most important aspects of the debate. The most prominent champion for the official version in France is Jérôme Quirante, who also wrote a book called September 11 and the Conspiracy Theories. Quirante also participated in numerous conferences and television debates on 9/11 in his own country. But the flagship for the debunkers worldwide is certainly the American magazine Popular Mechanics. In 2006, they published a book called Debunking 9/11 Myths, in which the authors purport to have refuted all the major claims against the official version by the 9/11 truth movement.
Jim Miggs is the editor of Popular Mechanics magazine. In 2005, he and a staff of reporters decided to take on the factual and scientific claims made by members of the 9/11 conspiracy movement. The results were first published in a magazine article, then more fully developed in a book titled Debunking 9/11 Myths, Why Conspiracy Theories Can't Stand Up to the Facts.
I think what Popular Mechanics did with the 9/11 conspiracy theory was just about one of the best things ever done in the history of skepticism. That is exactly how it should be done. Here's the claim, here's the answer. Here's the claim, here's the answer. By the end, they got nothing to stand on. Boom, end of story.
But is it really so? The debate on September 11 can roughly be divided into these areas of discussion. We have the four hijackings as the overarching event of the day, and we have the three different locations that were hit by the four airplanes. One of them hit the Pentagon, another crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the other two hit the Twin Towers in New York. The debate on the hijackings is divided in three parts. The first one focuses on the air defense and whether the failure to intercept the hijacked airplanes was accidental or intentional. The second focuses on the hijackers and whether they were actually aboard the airplanes or just the usual patsies. The third part focuses on the aircraft themselves and whether the four airplanes used in the attacks were the same ones that took off from the airports that morning or were something that only resembled them from the outside. What initially raised suspicions on the true role of the military on September 11 is the fact that the U.S. air defense, which is arguably the most advanced and sophisticated in the world, was unable to intercept even one of the four hijacked airplanes in the course of over 1.5 hours.
I remember thinking, where on earth are the interceptors? I'm an old interceptor pilot, and it's absolutely unbelievable that hijacked airliners could fly around for an hour and 40 minutes without being intercepted.
As a former Minister of National Defense, why did airplanes fly around for an hour and a half without interceptors being scrambled? Take them, with a quick reaction alert. They should have been in the air in 5 minutes or 10 minutes. If not, as a Minister of National Defense, I would want to say, why not?
This astonishing failure to respond was remarked by Senator Mark Dayton in the post 9/11 congressional hearings.
But what I find much more shocking and alarming were the repeated and catastrophic failures of the leaders in charge and the other people responsible to do their jobs, to follow established procedures, to follow direct orders from civilian and military commanders.
The official justification for this failure is a series of blunders, miscommunications, and mistakes that has come to be known as the incompetence theory. The real reason for the failure to intercept the four aircraft seems to have been the high number of military exercises that were being run by NORAD on September 11 out of their base in Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado. As Webster Tarpley noted in his book 9/11 Synthetic Terror, staff exercises or command exercises are perfect for a rogue network, which is forced to conduct its operations using the same communications and computer systems used by other officers who are not necessarily party to the illegal operation. Interestingly enough, on the evening of September 10th, the security level for the NORAD computer system called Infocon had been dropped to normal, the lowest level. This made it easier for anyone to penetrate or compromise the computer networks of the air defense system. On September 11, between 4 and 10 military exercises had been scheduled, some of them involving false hijacks of commercial airplanes. This unusual number of exercises had two major consequences. One, they moved a large number of fighters out to Canada and Alaska. Two, they created a major confusion in the system as soon as the real hijackings were reported.
We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
process of authorization for scrambles was lengthy and complicated.
Hey, I just talked to Otis here, and he said they needed NEAD's authorization.
Confusion and pressure kept mounting.
I don't know where I'm scrambling these guys to. I need a direction, destination.
At times, communications were jammed.
If you could do me a favor and have them call us, we cannot call out for some reason.
Some in the military quickly realized the simulations were causing a problem.
You know what? Get rid of this goddamn sim. Hey, turn the sim switches off. Get rid of that crap.
I'll have to cancel the exercise because this is ridiculous.
But they were not canceled, even after both towers in New York had been hit. When everyone knew America was under attack, the war games continued.
You guys watching the news?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure. I've been watching for about 10 minutes. Did they suspend the exercise?
Not at this time, no.
Apparently, someone took advantage of the situation. While the plane headed for the Pentagon was quickly approaching from the west, an unknown source, which was never identified, reported that American 11 was headed towards the Capitol, even though the plane had already crashed into the North Tower.
I just had a report that American 11 is still in the air and it's heading towards Washington.
American 11 is still in the air?
This attracted all the attention towards the so-called phantom plane.
He's still airborne, he's still a hijack out there, but we can't get a position on him.
The jets from Langley were prepared to intercept it.
I don't know if they might want to reach America down there, though, too.
We have Langley on battle station for now.
Okay.
Then they were scrambled straight for Washington.
Foxy, scramble Langley, have course of Washington. Area.
But a different command post called Giant Killer sent the fighters out to the ocean.
Okay, where you want them?
We want them in the Whiskey 386 area.
This didn't sit well with the operations center.
Freaking Giant Killer and their wisdom sent them out over the water when we scrambled them to Washington.
By the time the plane headed for the Pentagon was circling the Capitol, it was too late for the Langley jets to intercept it. Even after the Pentagon was hit, the war games were not suspended. And again, while United 93 was being hijacked, another false alarm attracted the attention in the opposite direction.
Did you get the word? I got a Delta 89er south-southeast of Toledo.
Delta 89, that's a hijack. They think it's a possible hijack. South of Cleveland, we have a code on
Air Force Base.
I'm sorry to be so brief and quick on this, but there's another possible hijack about 50 miles east of Toledo, and you guys are the closest, and we need somebody airborne.
But instead of getting help, his authority was questioned.
What authority is this coming from? What authority is this coming from? The DO is the best I can tell you.
Nezipity vented his frustration to his superior, Colonel Marr.
He's going to tell his commander, the commander's going to call you. He doesn't believe the authority.
And they tried Duluth Air Force Base.
What about Duluth? Okay, Duluth, you got no fighters.
Nezipany went all the way to the Western Quadrant looking for help.
Assistant Major Kenny, who is this?
Hey, Kenny. This is Nasty, how you doing?
Hey, doing all right.
Hey, we're not doing so good right now. What I'd like to do, possibly steal some aircraft out of Fargo from you guys.
But here, too, there were no planes ready for scramble. They tried Syracuse, but 20 minutes was the best they could do.
Syracuse 2 airborne in 20 minutes.
They tried Alpena, but the planes were just returning from their training.
The Alpena thing isn't what we thought. There's four guys coming home from the range right now.
They started looking for planes that were already up in the air for exercises.
So, anybody in training, send them home. Missions of Falcons, send them home.
But those planes were spent at that point.
They got no weapons. They just went around circling around up to the range. They blew all their loads.
By the time refueled and armed jets were finally scrambled, the Delta flight turned out to be another false alarm.
He was a hijacked aircraft. He is not a hijacked aircraft. He's taking precautionary measures and he's landing at Cleveland Center.
Only after the Delta flight had landed were the war games finally suspended.
Hello, this is our Captain Pierson, what we need you to do right now is to terminate all exercise inputs coming into Cheyenne Mountain.
By then, also the fourth hijacked airplane had been turned into a pile of smoking rubble.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. What you are listening to is the voice of Joseph Culp. He is an actor. He narrates September 11th, the New Pearl Harbor, 5-hour documentary, 3 DVDs. This is our thank you gift today on Guns and Butter to those KPFA listeners who can donate at the $140 level. $140, I know that's a chunk of change. It is 5 hours long. It is three DVDs, professionally produced. And, in fact, the documentary was written and produced by Massimo Mazzucco, of course, a wonderful Italian filmmaker. He is going to produce a special run for KPFA for our fund drive. So if you could help us out here, become a member, $25. A $50 membership is a regular membership. $140, we'd be happy to provide you with September 11th, the new Pearl Harbor. But you need to give us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $140, and we can provide you with this incredible thank you gift. In fact, this is a 5 hour documentary, all divided up into chapters, so it's easy to move around. Now, when you heard Joseph Culp talk about the narration being divided into three parts, air defense, hijackers, and aircraft, he's only talking about the first DVD. And the audio I am going to play you today, of course, are only excerpts from the first DVD. There are the second DVD covers the Pentagon, Flight 93, and the Twin Towers. 1-800-439-5732. I'm sure you got the idea. This is only the very little beginning of a 5 hour documentary that is really incredible. It took Massimo Mazzucco many years to produce this. 1-800-439-5732. $140, and we would be delighted to send you this incredible documentary. What's one of the things that's different about this, as I mentioned in the very beginning, is that it gives the whole history of the public debate on 9/11. So it includes the official story. It includes what the independent researchers have come up with. It includes the debunking. They call it the debunking, of course. People came forward to challenge what independent researchers were coming up with. You heard Jim Miggs of Popular Mechanics mentioned from 2005 in a book called Debunking 9/11 Myths, among many others. And, you know, this is a real stroll down memory lane for me because I, and of course the listeners to Guns and Butter, sort of lived this whole history these past, 13 years. I remember back in, what was it? It was in, here's the date, May 30th, 2007. Todd Fletcher and I, works with David Ray Griffin on the writing of his books. Of course, David Ray Griffin has written 10 books on 9/11. We produced a show with David Ray Griffin called Debunking 9/11 Debunking. So the debunkers came forward to debunk the research, and then David Ray Griffin had to debunk them. So you can see how the public debate has gone around and around and around for 13 years. And that's one of the really good things about this five-hour documentary, September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, is that it includes some of that very important history, that history that you and I and Yarrow and many of us lived. September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, three DVDs, 5 hours long. Our gift to you for a very generous pledge today on KPFA Free Speech Radio of $140. Give us a call, please, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And while you're calling or considering pledging today to support the wonderful work of Massimo Mazzucco and the work that we do here on Guns and Butter, I wanted to mention that a good friend of mine, Tony Rango, and I are getting ready to kick off what we consider is going to be a very exciting campaign on Guns and Butter. And I wanted to encourage all of you to go to gunsandbutter.org. www.guns.org and sign up for our email list. We've got a new page up. We have a working email list. We want to keep you in the loop with all of what's happening with Guns and Butter in the present and in the future. This is only the very little beginning. So if you go to www.gunsandbutter.org, you can sign up for our email list, and we can keep you in the loop with all of the exciting things that we have planned in the future. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. This is a fun drive for KPFA. We are offering a 3-DVD set, September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, 12 years of public debate on 9/11. For a very generous pledge of $140, give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. You heard the beginning, the introduction, the parallels between Pearl Harbor that kicked off the United States' involvement in World War II, the parallels with September 11th, 2001. Then you heard about the air defenses. I believe one of the voices you heard there was Dr. Bob Bowman, very familiar to Guns and Butter listeners and 9/11 activists. Where were the interceptors, the air defense? And then they went on to the military drills and the war games that were confusing air traffic controllers. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, a very generous pledge of $140, and we will send you this 3-DVD set, September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor. The New Pearl Harbor is a 5-hour documentary that summarizes 12 years of public debate on 9/11. All the most important issues in the debate are presented in full detail, showing both the positions of those who reject the official version, the 9/11 truth movement, and the positions of those who support it, called the debunkers. You can be the judge. That written by the writer and director Massimo Mazzucco. September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We're sort of automated this time. I'm not getting cards. 1-800-439-5732. If you'd like to join those people who have pledged, give us a call. 1-800-439-5732. 3 DVDs, September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor. Very comprehensive. Lots of detail, covers all the subjects. Well, what do you think? Should we go back to a little audio? Let's go on. We are going to start with, I believe, the fact that, as Hamid Ghul once said to me, no heads rolled after 9/11.
The final argument against the incompetence theory is offered by researcher Nafiz Ahmed.
If we try to explain it by using the incompetence theory, it doesn't make sense. For example, if it was incompetent, we would expect that there would have been a normal inquiry into what went wrong. We would have expected that there would be some kind of reprimand, that certain officials would be downgraded, or they would lose their jobs, or something would have happened to correct the situation. But we find that there has been no such reprimands at all.
Not only that didn't happen, but the opposite took place. After 9/11, most of the high-ranking people involved in this catastrophic failure were either confirmed to their posts or promoted to higher levels. Condoleezza Rice, who had misrepresented the information the government had on the attacks in a sworn testimony, kept her post as National Security Advisor and went on to become Secretary of State in the following Bush administration. General Eberhard, the NORAD commander who didn't think of recalling the war games as soon as he knew his country was under attack, was chosen to lead the newly created U.S. Northern Command, which the Department of Defense has termed the nation's premier military homeland defense organization. Donald Rumsfeld, who acted more like an estranged passerby than the Secretary of Defense, kept his post at the Pentagon and began enjoying the largest increase in military spending after the Vietnam War. Richard B. Myers, despite the total breakdown under his leadership, was promoted to chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest military post in the country. On September 13, confirmation hearings were held for General Myers, as if nothing ever happened, while people were still being pulled alive from the rubble at Ground Zero.
How do you feel about United 175 reaching 510 knots?
Physically impossible. They have a clock airspeed of 510 knots with a commercial airliner at sea level, but it's physically impossible.
Like 175 hit the second tower. They said it was going at roughly 560 miles an hour at sea level.
No, that's impossible. You need so much power to push yourself through that air. So the engines have the right amount of horsepower for cruising at 30,000 feet at 500 plus miles an hour. To do that at ground level, you need 6 times that amount of power. Those engines can't put out 6 times more power. If you changed up the motors so they were motors that had 6 times the thrust, then, you know, theoretically you could, but then the structure is not strong enough. Under all circumstances, I'd say an absolute resounding no.
One question becomes inevitable at this point. If those were military drones and not regular airliners, what happened to the passengers? With certainty, no one can answer this question. One thing we do know, however, the CIA has been developing plans for covert operations that involve the in-flight swapping of commercial airliners with military drones since the 1960s. One such plan was called Operation Northwoods, and it detailed how to replace a civil airliner with a military drone in midair, unbeknownst to the air traffic controllers. After the swap, the airliner would be landed in a military base. The drone would continue to fly, appearing on radar as the original plane, and would be remotely guided all the way into the target. We don't know whether this is the actual end the passengers met, but one thing we can say for sure: those who called their relatives from their cell phones could not have placed those calls from the airplanes in flight. Minutes after the fourth plane had crashed in Pennsylvania, news was already circulating that several passengers had made calls with their cell phones from the hijacked airplanes.
"We are being hijacked. We are being hijacked." Those frightening words were uttered by a passenger aboard United Flight 93 who was able to call emergency personnel on his cell phone before the plane crashed in western Pennsylvania.
And tonight we're getting reports of cell phone calls from at least three of those four flights. On the second flight that came out of Boston, that was the second flight of the day, and also went into one of the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, there was a businessman who got off two cell phone calls to his father.
The CNN commentator Barbara Olson, wife of U.S. Solicitor General Ted Olson. She reportedly called her husband twice on a mobile phone to tell him her plane was being hijacked.
The problem is that in 2001, it was practically impossible to make a call with a cell phone from an airplane at cruising altitudes. The whole idea behind cellular phones is that they use low power transmitters, both to keep the cost of the units down and to preserve battery life. It is up to the receiving towers on the ground to pick up and boost their signal before they route it through the system. It is commonly thought that beyond 10,000 feet in altitude, most cell phones become useless. Passenger planes normally cruise at 30,000 feet and beyond. The editors of Popular Mechanics, however, maintain that cell phones do work from cruising airplanes, even at maximum altitudes.
David Dunbar.
With regard to the cell phones, we did what any reporter would do. We talked to experts in the field, and in fact, cell phones do work at that altitude, up to 35,000 feet and higher. And
in 2001?
In 2001, and it might be instructive for you to talk to some of the cell phone experts.
Instead of talking to experts, Japanese television decided to take matters into their own hands. In 2003, they conducted an on-camera experiment near Ontario, Canada, to verify the actual reach of cell phones from different altitudes.
The cellular phone system used in the experiment in Canada is the one used in the United States. Three cell phones, each from different telephone companies, were used. The experiment begins at 1,000 feet.
Hello?
The results were the same with the other two. Next, we went up to 4,000 feet. Then, Company B's phone stopped working at 4,000 feet. And when the aircraft rose to 6,000 feet, Company A's phone also became useless. At 8,000 feet, none of the three cell phones worked anymore.
No service on A, no service on B, no service on C.
In other words, at an altitude of 35,000 feet, cell phones would have been totally useless.
There is another problem besides altitude that makes calling from a cell phone unthinkable from a cruising airplane, and that is speed. Calling from an aircraft with a cell phone would be like calling from a car traveling at 500 miles per hour. The connection would continuously need to be transferred from one receiving station to the next, and then to the next, and again to the next. The transfer procedure between two receiving stations is called handoff, and it relies on continuous triangulations between the receiving towers in order to establish the exact position of the caller. As the mobile unit approaches the handoff zone, the first tower senses the weakening of the signal and prepares to transfer the call to the second. When the second tower senses the signal is strong enough to take over, the handoff procedure is initiated. If everything goes well, the call is rerouted into the system by the new receiving station. But the speed by which an airplane approaches and crosses over the handoff zone is so high that the towers wouldn't have the time to complete the handoff procedure. The call would be dropped, and the person would need to dial the number from scratch. If one considers the altitude and the speed problems combined, it should be clear that the chances of having an actual conversation with a cell phone from a cruising airplane are practically nil. Even after 2001, both altitude and speed problems remain. In 2005, the Washington Post wrote, "Most cell phones can't reach a station from beyond 10,000 feet. Another technical hurdle is to find a way that cell phone calls would be handed off from one cell tower to another on the ground when an aircraft is traveling at 500 miles an hour." And even 10 years after 9/11, people who try to use their cell phone from cruising altitudes are bound to get the same results. Once it became clear that the passengers could not have placed their calls from the cell phones on the airplanes, the official narrative on this issue became more and more ambiguous and non-committal. Theodore Olson, who had initially told the press he had received two cell phone calls from his wife Barbara, changed his story to calls made from an airphone. And by the time the 9/11 Commission published their final report, only one mention on the cell phone calls remained. Shortly thereafter, wrote the Commission, passengers and flight crew began a series of calls from GTA airphones and cellular phones. No indication on which calls were made from cell phones and which ones with airphones was given. The authorities from the Massawi trial also avoided being too specific on the origin of the calls. Within the official documentation, they released this flash animation, which contains all the basic information on the four hijacked airplanes. By clicking on any of the flights, one can view the passengers list. By clicking on the telephone icon at the bottom, the passengers who have made phone calls are highlighted. And by clicking on any of the passengers' names, the list of the calls they have made is displayed. Each of the calls lists the exact time it was placed, the duration, the initial part of the number dialed, and the name of the person receiving the call. But the number from which the phone call was placed is missing. The only information available is the location on the plane the calls were presumably made from, row 30 in this case. It's as if the authorities were trying to suggest that the calls were made from airphones without having to put it down on paper. Only in two cases did the authorities openly state that a cell phone was used. One is the call allegedly placed to 911 by a passenger who had locked himself in a laboratory where airphones are not available. The second is a call placed by flight attendant C.C. Lyles to her husband, who later described his surprise in receiving a call from her cell phone in a television interview.
Once the phone got disconnected, then I sat up in the bed like it was like I just woke up. I'm like, was that a real call? So I looked at the caller ID and noticed that it was a call, and it was from her cell phone. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. How can she call me from on the plane from a cell phone? Because cell phones don't work on a plane. That's what I'm thinking.
As only these two phone calls were admitted by the authorities, the debunkers have universally adopted the only two cell phone calls made position. But one thing is the number of cell phone calls admitted to. Another is the number of calls that were actually made. In the days following 9/11, the FBI interviewed the various people who had received a phone call from their relatives on the planes, and their reports tell a different story. One of the reports reads, starting at approximately 6:30 Pacific Standard Time, which is 9:30 New York time, Dina Burnett received a series from 3 to 5 cellular phone calls from her husband, Thomas Burnett.
You are listening to the voice of actor Joseph Culp, who is narrating a 5-hour documentary on 9/11 called September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, 5 hours long, three DVDs, written and directed by Italian filmmaker Massimo Mazzucco. September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, our gift to you today for a very generous pledge to KPFA of $140. $140, September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor. Please give us a call here if you can support us, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner, and of course, this is Guns and Butter, and I'm absolutely delighted to be able to bring you just a little audio from this incredible five-hour documentary. It was shown in large part at the 9/11 Film Festival. I saw a lot of you there, a lot of Guns and Butter supporters, a lot of people who come to the annual event put on by the Northern California 9/11 Truth Alliance. And people were coming out of the theater and saying, well, Bonnie, I heard your voice in there. And, you know, I'm going to have to pay some more attention to this and watch the whole thing again, because I don't know where my voice comes in, but somebody, I mean, I guess he must have taken some audio from one of the interviews here on Guns and Butter. So I'm going to have to find that. September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, three DVDs, 5 hours long, for a $140 pledge to Free Speech Radio, KPFA. You can support us. You can support the filmmaker, Massimo Mazzucco, support Guns and Butter, and most of all, KPFA, by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. I want to thank all of the lovely supporters who've already called in with their contributions. I'd also like to thank David Lochner in Palo Alto for supporting KPFA. Thank you. Also, thank you to Esther Adler in Berkeley. Thank you, Esther. And how about a big thank you to Jeffrey Dickman in Richmond, California. You can join those supporters by calling us at 1-800-439-5732. Brian Schuler called in. He says he's working and he'll call back because he wants that pledge item on September 11th. So thank you so much, Brian. And also a very big thank you to Frida Winter in Pacific Grove. You can join all of these great supporters of KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. A $25 donation makes you a member of KPFA for a year. No donation is too small. I know $140 is a lot of money, but it's also a lot of premium, so it's a great value. 1-800-439-5732. Now, we had to cut off in the middle of the explication of the cell phone calls, and that's very complicated, and that goes on for quite a while, and actually the end of that segment is very creepy, I must say. We started that with, you know, in this segment, I sort of took a few little cuts out of different sections. We hopped around. We skipped the incompetence theory. There's a whole section on incompetence theory. We started with the promotions, the fact that the people in charge on September 11th not only did not lose their jobs, but many, if not most of them, were promoted. And I played a small cut out of a longer section on the speeds of the airplanes. Now, obviously, we're looking at the official story and how fast these commercial jets were flying at sea level or very low altitude. And a lot of experts, pilots, even someone from Boeing Airlines is interviewed to see if this is possible. And they also know, no, this is not possible. You cannot fly a commercial jetliner at a low altitude like that at the speeds that the government claims they were going. And so I just played you a little bit of that. Then there's a section on, of course, the planes. whether they were really commercial airliners or drones. We just sort of hit the tail end of that and then went into the passenger cell phone calls. And this first DVD is almost 2 hours long, so all I've really been able to play you is maybe, 35 minutes? So this documentary is packed. 1-800-439-5732. September 11th, the new Pearl Harbor, a 3-DVD set. It is a 5-hour documentary that summarizes 12 years of public debate on 9/11. And so in the public debate is included what the government is saying, what 9/11 truth activists and researchers are saying, then those people who come forward to debunk what the independent researchers are saying. As I mentioned to you before, here on Guns and Butter, we produced a show with David Ray Griffin debunking 9/11 debunking. So the debate goes on. 1-800-439-5732, $140 donation, and we would be delighted to send you this terrific 3-DVD set, September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor. All the most important issues in the debate are presented in full detail, showing both the positions of those who reject the official version, the 9/11 truth movement, and the positions of those who support it, called the debunkers. You can be the judge. September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, a 5-hour documentary. 1-800-439-5732. I want to thank everyone who has so very generously pledged today. It's wonderful to see people call up, support the show, support KPFA. I just refreshed the screen here, and there's a whole bunch of more people to thank. Before I do that, I do want to encourage people to go to www.gunsandbutter.org and sign up for our email list. We've got a new working page up for Guns and Butter. Tony Rango is going to work with me. We're going to start what's going to be a very exciting Guns and Butter campaign. We want to keep all of you in the loop. So please go to gunsandbutter.org, give us your email, and we will let you know what is happening. That's GUNSANDBUTTER.ORG. I would like to thank Joyce Eden in Cupertino for supporting KPFA on Guns and Butter today. Also, thank you to Mary Bergquist in Somerset, California. Also, thank you to Andrea Zanella in Palo Alto, who called in and pledged today on Guns and Butter. Thank you, Andrea. Thank you to Donna Watson in Guerneville. Thank you, Donna. And also thank you to Roy Jarl in San Francisco. You can join these great supporters of KPFA, supporters of Guns and Butter, and supporters of Massimo Mazzucco's new film, September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. I do want to give a little shout out to co-producer Yara Mako, who's been unable to work on the show these last few weeks. He and his wife have just given birth to twins, identical twins, if you can believe that. I just wanted to say hello to Yara and thank Yara for all the great work he does on Guns and Butter. 1-800-439-5732, September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, 12 years of public debate on 9/11. 1-800-439-5732, $140 donation, and we would be delighted to send you this 3-DVD set. So the DVDs are in 3 DVDs, okay, and I wanted to, there's so much detail. I could talk for an hour on all the different chapters in these DVDs. The first DVD is the introduction, the parallels between Pearl Harbor and September 11th, the air defense, the hijackers, the airplanes. So all the hijackers are gone into in detail. The air defense, we just heard a little bit of that. The airplanes, DVD 2, the Twin Tower, the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, Flight 93. Lots of detail on all of that. Twin Towers continued on DVD 3, then Building 7, and the epilogue. And, of course, it's all very nicely chopped up into chapters with headings, so you can scoot around in the DVDs. You don't have to watch it from start to finish, but it is an incredible narrative. And, of course, Joseph Culp does a marvelous job of narrating it. And if you were at the 9/11 Film Festival in 2008 when we showed Joseph Culp's drama, new movie, drama of 9/11 called The Reflecting Pool, you might have met him there. Very nice guy. Joseph Culp narrating Massimo Mazzucco's September 11th, The New Pearl Harbor, three DVDs, 5 hours long. Our gift to you today on Guns and Butter for a very generous pledge to KPFA of $140. As I mentioned before, Massimo Mazzucco, I talked to him on the phone. He's such a delightful, wonderful person. As soon as I emailed him that I wanted to use his film, he immediately called me from Italy. He helped me out on the internet, showed me how to do things, to download audio. He is out of the films, but he's having a special run made just for listeners and supporters of KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. It looks like there's a few more people showing up on the computer here who have pledged, and now I'm getting confused as to who I've thanked before and who I haven't. But I do want to thank Lad Cahoon in Novato. Thank you. Also, thank you to Susan McAllister in Berkeley, who called in. Oh, I've only got 30 seconds. Thank you to Eileen Martinez Carey in Grayton. Thank you to Roy Jarl in San Francisco. I think I may have mentioned him before. I can't remember. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Thank you so very much for pledging today. And be sure to go to www.gunsandbutter.org. Sign up for our email list, and we'll let you know what's going on with Guns and Butter and the very exciting campaign that Tony Rango and I are going to be conducting in the future for Guns and Butter. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, it's potpourri, loosely connected this and that, with chat from me, music by David Rovix, satire by The Final Edition, and more. I hope you'll stay tuned. This week is another potpourri show. Potpourri number 4. Potpourri sounds better than hodgepodge, which means the same thing. We feature a bit of this and a bit of that, loosely connected by the theme of the little guy versus the system. Or if the little guy sounds too sexist, too androcentric, we could say the 99% versus the 1%. Loosely connected by that theme, but only loosely. We'll hear some chat from me, new music by David Rovix, and this and that. In a few minutes, I want to chat a bit about Mr. Donald Trump. Now don't touch that dial. I promise that what I will say is quite different than what was said in the last 400 commentaries you've read and heard on Trump. That's an easy promise to keep, because the last 400 commentaries all said pretty much the same thing, right? Saying something different is pretty easy. You gotta wonder why so few people have done it. But before that, I've got a recording I love that I was never able to fit into the show. It's a very funny public service announcement about using energy wisely and protecting the environment. A public service announcement sponsored by the Koch brothers. Well, not actually. It's actually satire by the comedy group The Final Edition. Well, worth a listen. Here goes.
This portion of the Final Edition Radio Hour is brought to you by the Oil is Green Foundation.
Why do we hate oil so? Why do we blame oil for global warming? The pollution of our air and seas, the death of millions of species. Oil is not our enemy. Oil is a child of Mother Earth. Oil is numberless trillions of trees, shrubs, plants, flowers, fruits, grains, and as many species of birds, reptiles, mammals, living organisms, large and small, all totally organic, every single cell of which passed away of natural causes. Gently compressed by organic, natural processes, oil ages deep in the bosom of Mother Earth for millions and millions of years. Like the finest wine in a vast underground cellar, It matures into thick, luscious, darkly shining, nutrient-rich, intensely concentrated earth juice. Oil is the blood that flows through our planet's hearts and veins. Oil is the essence of life. So let's stop wasting our time and money on unreliable, renewable energy. Stop destroying America's purpled majesty with ugly wind and solar farms. Stop turning her amber waves of grain into useless ethanol instead of feeding a hungry planet. And thank Mother Earth for oil, the greenest of all her children.
This has been a message from Coke Industries Oil and Gas Division.
Things go better with Coke.
Some funny satire by The Final Edition. That recording is courtesy of Scooter of the Inner Side out in Houston. Thanks once again. Now on to Trump. As promised, I'm going to say something different from the last 400 discussions of Trump that you've sat through. I'm not going to criticize Trump. Instead, I want to explore how current events involving Trump show the god-awful corruption of the system. They also show the god-awful corruption of the corporate-controlled so-called mainstream news media. And they show how, in America today, democracy is more pretty fiction than reality. That's the interesting story connected to Trump. And it's a story we've experienced before, whenever an insurgent challenges the powers that be. We could go back to Eugene V. Debs, but we've seen the story more recently with, say, Ross Perot, Dennis Kucinich, Ralph Nader, and even as we speak, Bernie Sanders. We saw it with the Occupy movement. So the interesting story here is not the badness of Donald Trump's character and policies and beliefs. That's too obvious to be interesting. No, to me, the interesting story is the system's reaction to Trump. And that reaction reveals how corrupt the system actually is. That's the story here. So I think Donald Trump is doing America a favor by revealing how corrupt and anti-democratic the system actually is, especially the media. I'm not going to go into Trump's own vices and follies here. I'm not going to deplore Trump's own lack of judgment, knowledge, wit, and taste. That's how people used to talk back in Jonathan Swift's day, back in the early 18th century. Trump's want of judgment, knowledge, wit, and taste. I will grant that Trump is deficient in all four and well-stocked in folly. I won't belabor the point because the entire U.S. media have been beating this drum. Beating the drum in unison, without pause, day after day, month after month after month. That's what caught my attention. The unison of all these media voices. Diversity of opinion? Forget it. Instead, a constant, unending refrain of Trump is a fool, Trump is a menace. The Republican establishment must find a way to stop Trump, and democracy be damned. If the powers that be cannot stop Trump, then the voters must. The same message, over and over and over again, every day, filling the editorial pages of all the newspapers, and all the news pages, too. The newspapers and the thoughtful magazines are all on the same page here. Even the mostly apolitical magazine, The New Yorker. The New Yorker, famous for its fine writing, famous for its excellent long-form journalism, and for its terrific droll cartoons. I'm just browsing through a stack of recent issues here. I see anti-Trump cover illustrations on the issues of February 1 and May 23, 2016. In the New Yorker's issue of April 25, every single cartoon is about Trump and against Trump. 17 cartoons, every one of them on the theme of how awful Donald Trump is. I have read The New Yorker for decades, and I do not recall ever seeing anything like this before. As far as I recall, The New Yorker has satirized no other presidential candidate in this election cycle. Again, I have no love for Donald Trump, but let me say just three words. George W. Bush. In mine considered judgment, George W. Bush is a warmonger, a psychopath, an ignoramus, a liar, a religious hypocrite, and a despiser of the Bill of Rights. He is also a loyal and, for a while, effective servant of Wall Street, servant of the Fortune 500, of the so-called defense industry, and of the national security state. Just to recite a few highlights of his presidency. He allowed 9/11 to happen and did not even fire anybody when it did. And he actively resisted forming a commission to investigate afterwards. He allowed New Orleans to be drowned and praised his appointed Director of Emergency Management afterwards. Attaboy, Brownie! Anybody remember New Orleans? George W. Bush placed U.S. foreign policy entirely into the hands of right-wing neocon crazies. He started two obscene, entirely needless, and ruinously expensive wars. Wars which, by the way, are still being fought. He destabilized the entire Middle East. He cut taxes for the corporations, he cut taxes for the rich, and he cut services for the rest of us. There's much more, but I'll stop here. All the while, the U.S. corporate-controlled media were entirely behind George W. Bush. Always talking about how presidential he was acting. Always talking about how he was growing in office. The media did everything they could to overlook his crimes, past and present. The media denigrated and mocked his political opponents, Senator Al Gore in 2000, Senator John Kerry in 2004. The media chose to overlook the fact that Bush was not elected to office, but was installed in a post-election coup. Installed by five right-wingers on the Supreme Court. You may or may not recall, the court halted Florida's vote recount in 2000 when it became apparent that Al Gore had won Florida. Hence, Al Gore had won the presidency. In fact, a recount, which didn't count, demonstrated that Al Gore did win Florida and was elected president. Gore was elected, but Bush was installed. There's a name for a sequence of events like this, and the name is coup. The American media had no trouble with the coup, no trouble whitewashing and praising George W. Bush. That's because Bush was a proven member of and servant of the establishment. Bush could be depended on to fight for the interests of the oligarchs. So could Al Gore, by the way, and so can Hillary Clinton. But I digress. George W. Bush is an ignoramus who effectively championed many destructive policies. Saint Ronald Reagan was an ignoramus, suffering from senile dementia through most of his presidency, who championed many destructive policies. To be sure, neither was a total ignoramus. They were both highly skilled in the craft of American political maneuvering, as is Donald Trump. Donald Trump also is an ignoramus who champions many destructive policies. Since when does that disqualify anyone from the presidency? Since when does that trigger 17 New Yorker cartoons in a single issue? No, for the establishment, the problem with Trump is that he is a loose cannon. He doesn't champion all the causes that the oligarchs champion, and some of their causes he resists. For example, Trump refuses to pretend that Russia is a great enemy. That's not good for defense industry profits. Trump is in favor of Social Security. The oligarchs want all that money that is ably managed by the Social Security Administration to be put into the hands of Wall Street investment managers. You can decide which one you trust to take care of your retirement income. Trump is even in favor of preserving Medicare. He even said, "You can't have people dying in the streets." "Oh, yes, you can," say the 1%. And Cruz and Rubio and Ryan and Christie and Carly Fiorina and Jeb Bush could be depended on to help make it happen. But Trump cannot be depended on. For the establishment, that is Trump's real sin. He might not fight hard to abolish Social Security. He might not call for massive new defense spending to counter the alleged Russian threat. So the establishment desperately wants Trump stopped. But why are the entire mass media vociferously parroting this party line and nothing but? Silly question. Now you can see the actual function of the corporate-owned press in a rather dubious democracy. Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman pegged the real role of the media well in their book Manufacturing Consent. That book is a generation old, and its examples of press bias and propaganda are from the Reagan years. Well, you could read the book and look around. See how relevant Chomsky's and Herman's conclusions are to the current scene. Works for me. One last example. On April 5th, Ted Cruz managed to win the Republican primary in Wisconsin, one of the very few primaries in which he came out ahead of Trump. I read about it in both my local paper and in the New York Times. In both rags, the emphasis was on Cruz, 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 headlines about Cruz, photographs of a triumphant Cruz, no photos of Trump. The establishment has doubts about Cruz's effectiveness, but they love his policies. So, Cruz got the big play in one of his very few primary victories. But wait, there's more. On the same day, insurgent, self-described socialist Bernie Sanders beat the establishment candidate Hillary Clinton in the Wisconsin Democratic Party primary. Beat her yet again. The New York Times mentioned this victory only in the Cruz story, and only in passing, in a third-level headline, with the details buried far back in the story. Yet another trouncing by Bernie, who came out of nowhere, of establishment favorite Clinton. Isn't that the real story here? Or at least a story as important as one of the few times Cruz came out ahead of anybody? No pictures of Bernie Sanders, though. In fact, barely a mention. In Wisconsin, on the Democrats' side, the progressive insurgent whomps the establishment candidate yet again. Okay, let's not give this any publicity. On the Republican side, the lone remaining establishment candidate narrowly beats the loose cannon challenger. There's the story, laddies. Play it up big. Trump can be defeated. The voters back the establishment. That's the party line for today. Play it up big. Print two photos of Cruz. Here's mine humble opinion. As the kid said in the classic old New Yorker cartoon, I say it's Brussels sprouts, and I say the hell with it. But enough grumbling from me. David Rovix has put out a few new albums in the past couple of years. One of these albums is called The Other Side, and a couple tracks on it I really like. This song is timely, too. We're approaching the first anniversary of the murder of clergyman and South Carolina State Senator, the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, killed June 17, 2015. Pinckney was black and a pastor of a famous black Christian church, the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church, Emmanuel AME, in Charleston, South Carolina. Dylan Roof, a white man, was charged with the entirely unprovoked murder. There is a long and interesting history to Emmanuel AME Church. Mother Emmanuel, it is called. The church was founded by blacks, mostly by slaves, I assume, in 1816. One of its founders was the former slave Denmark Vesey. 6 years later, Vesey planned a large-scale slave revolt, scheduled for June 17, 1822. The plot was betrayed to the authorities by a slave. When the authorities learned of the planned revolt, Vesey and dozens of others were rounded up. Vesey and more than 30 others were executed. An angry white mob burned down Emmanuel AME Church. Then, after Nat Turner's rebellion in 1834, Charleston banned all black churches. Emmanuel AME's congregation met secretly until after the Civil War. Then a new church building was erected. In the 20th century, Mother Emmanuel Church continued to be a thorn in the side of the white segregation establishment in South Carolina. It was very active in the civil rights movement in the 1960s. In 1962, in a voter registration drive, the pastor and 900 others were arrested. This is the church in which, on June 17, 2015, a young white man, Dylan Roof, sat in on a Bible study class. After an hour, Roof suddenly pulled out a pistol and shot and killed the minister. Voices in his head told him to do this, he said. Nearby, on that day, on the lawn of the South Carolina State House in Charleston, the battle flag of the Confederate States of America proudly flew. So you could see the murder of the Reverend Clementa Pinckney as just another random act of violence. Or you could see it as one more page in a long and wide-ranging story. A story where whites attack uppity blacks. That's an old story in South Carolina, a story going back to Denmark Vesey and before that. And some of the story takes place right here in Mother Emmanuel Church. David Rovick's song is titled State House Lawn.
He was listening to voices talking in his head. If you grew up in America, you know exactly what they said. And with every job we lose, however bad things get, there's a black man in the White House on the TV set. And we can blame it all on him and his entire race, because they no longer know their place. You can hear the voices by the early light of dawn. You can see the flag waving on the State House lawn. He was listening to voices. You could say that he was crazy for thinking certain people are just born to be lazy. He could see it on the cop shows. They don't know right from wrong. The race war is coming, and now it won't be long. I promise it was not his original notion. If you want to start a war first, you have to set the war in motion. You can hear the voices by the early light of dawn. You can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. He was listening to voices who said the conflict's coming soon. And he walked into the church on the 17th of June, the very date of the rebellion that never was to be, for which 35 were hanged in that very city, for which the church was burned, for which the church was banned, for which there's been no atonement in a sick and troubled land. You can hear the voices, and by the early light of dawn, you can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. You can hear the voices, and by the early light of dawn, you can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. You can see the flag waving on the state house lawn.
David Rovick's State House Lawn, including some interesting violin by Billy Oskey in counterpoint. To hear more of Rovick's, find him in the Bandcamp website, davidrovics.bandcamp.com. And you can find the New World Notes archive of past shows at our own website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening. Advising illegitimi non carborundum, reminding you that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Ciao.
You can hear the voices, and by the early light of dawn, you can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. You can hear the voices, and by the early light of dawn, you can see the flag waving on the state house lawn. You can see the flag waving on the state house lawn.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today we're going to take a look at the hoax of Islamic terrorism. From 9/11, the global war on terror, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Iraq and Syria, to San Bernardino and the corporate media. It's a big agenda, so let's begin. It all comes back to 9/11. 9/11 was the pivotal event that has fast-tracked the pre-planned agenda for full-spectrum dominance by the U.S. as laid out in the PNAC document, or the Project for a New American Century document, called Rebuilding America's Defenses, in which they state that Americans wouldn't buy into the military buildup that would be needed for them to implement their plans without a new Pearl Harbor. 9/11 was their pre-planned and orchestrated new Pearl Harbor, exploited to demonize Muslims and to preemptively and illegally attack Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Pakistan, and more, and their justification for taking away our civil liberties. I would encourage you to do a little research on the PNAC and see for yourself. There's a new three-part film out about the PNAC called A Very Heavy Agenda by Robbie Martin. The 9/11 truth movement has documented so much evidence disproving the official story of 9/11 and exposing the government and media cover-up of the facts that if you still believe the government and controlled media's account of 9/11, which, by the way, is a conspiracy theory, you simply haven't been paying attention. If you're out of touch with what really happened 14 years ago on 9/11, then you're probably being taken in by the latest lies and deceptions. For the present situation in the Middle East and in our country to make sense, you really need to get it that what you've been told by the government and the media about 9/11 is a lie, and they continue to push those lies. Once you get that you've been lied to about 9/11, and I know that most of my listeners do get that, you'll also see that the global war on terror is a hoax, a deception, and a way to get you to support and finance our government's illegal and immoral military agenda. And now here's James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com on March 21st, 2010, talking about some of the more recent supposed domestic terrorist attacks.
Lawyers for four men indicted for allegedly planning to bomb a Jewish center in Riverdale, New York, have revealed that the entire scheme was concocted and planned by an FBI informant in the group. The defense in the case has filed a dismissal motion, citing the claim that Shahid Hussein was a paid FBI informant whose mission was to radicalize disaffected Muslims and recruit them to join a fake terror plot. The motion suggests that Hussein was provided with as much as $250,000 for the case and had a government-provided BMW, Hummer, and other cars to make him appear to be a well-funded foreign terrorist operative. The government well knew that their case had been a government-inspired creation from day one and that the defendants had not been independently seeking weapons or targets, the dismissal motion said. This development was by no means a surprise to analysts who have noted that every major domestic terror plot in the United States over the last two decades has been aided, abetted, funded, supplied, and often created by paid government informants. 8 years before bombs and nanothermite demolished the World Trade Center in New York, the original 1993 World Trade Center bombing was exposed as an FBI operation. The man who supplied the bomb-making materials to the bombers, a former Egyptian army officer named Imad Salem, was revealed to be an FBI informant who had been told to deliver the materials to the plotters. The original plan was to deliver fake materials so that the bombing could not go ahead, but FBI agents overseeing the case ordered him to give the real supplies to the plotters, and the attack went ahead, killing six and injuring 1,042 people. In December of 1993, the head of the FBI New York field office, James N. Fox, issued a blanket denial that the FBI had foreknowledge of the attacks, and the media stopped reporting on the story. Since then, the actual recordings between Salem and his FBI handler, Special Agent John Antichev, have been released.
He was start already building the bomb, which is went off in the World Trade Center. It was built by supervision from the Bureau and the GA, and we was all informed about it, and we know that the bomb start to be built. By who? By your confidential informant. What a wonderful, great case. Well, and then he put his head in the sand and said, oh, no, 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 that's not true. Okay, well, it's built with a different way in another place, and that's it.
Well, don't make any risk, you know, I'm just trying to be as honest with you as I can.
Of course, I appreciate that.
And as far as the, you know, the payments go and everything like that, they're there. I guarantee you that they are there.
In 2007, convicted Oklahoma City bombing co-conspirator Terry Nichols was able to file an affidavit in U.S. District Court in Utah, alleging that the OKC bombing and Timothy McVeigh had been directed by a high-ranking FBI official. The affidavit indicated that Nichols had been trying to go public with the information about McVeigh's FBI help for years, but had been prevented from speaking to the press. He had also contacted former Attorney General John Ashcroft with the information, but never received a reply. In 2006, it was revealed that the so-called Miami 7, who had allegedly been attempting to strike targets in the U.S., including the Sears Tower, had in fact been organized, led, and supplied by a government informant who had convinced them that he was an Al-Qaeda operative. The case disappeared from the headlines after it became apparent that the men were in fact a group of unemployed underachievers with below-average cognitive abilities living in a warehouse. In 2008, the so-called Fort Dix terror plot was also revealed to be the single-handed creation of two FBI informants who created a plot to stir six foreign-born Muslims into taking on the U.S. Army at Fort Dix. The plot was foiled when the dim-witted conspirators asked a Circuit City employee to transfer their jihad training video onto DVD and asked police for maps to the Fort Dix Army base. Analysts are expecting this latest revelation to also be quickly swept under the rug by the corporate media, and for the next large-scale domestic terror bust to be reported as if none of these previous incidents ever took place.
And that brings us to San Bernardino. As many of you already know, there's an amazing coincidence of drills being conducted right before these terrorist attacks happen, and the drills mimic exactly what happens. So, for example, on 9/11, there were many drills being conducted concerning America being attacked by terrorists. There were drills at the Boston Marathon bombing, drills prior to the Oklahoma City bombing, drills the morning of the 7/7 bombings in London in 2005, which took place at the exact four same locations and the exact same times as the real bombs. And there were drills on the morning of the recent Paris attacks, and there were drills prior to the recent San Bernardino shootings. Now, it seems to me that this is a huge red flag that another major deception is underway. In a December 7th article by Countercurrent News called "Eyewitness to San Bernardino Terror Attack Still Says Three Tall White Men Did It," the article goes on to say, quote, "The controversy over what really happened in San Bernardino last week is just beginning to heat up. Right after the lawyers for the alleged attacker's family said that they do not believe the suspects did it, yet another eyewitness to the attacks maintained that the real attackers were three tall, athletic, Caucasian men in tactical gear. It looked like their skin color was white. They appeared to be tall," the eyewitness said. Investigators with the ATF recovered police-issued firearms from the alleged shooters. So what we've been told about the San Bernardino shooting so far is already starting to look suspicious and even fraudulent. So now let's move on to take a look at ISIS. Here's what Professor Michelle Chusadovsky has to say
In a recent article called America's War on Terrorism, The Truth Will Prevail. It was posted on the website globalresearch.ca on November 27, 2015. And here goes. Amply documented but rarely mentioned in mainstream news, ISIS is a creation of U.S. intelligence, recruited, trained, and financed by the U.S. and its allies, including Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Israel, and Jordan. Those who ordered the bombing campaign are those who are behind the caliphate project. The Islamic State militia, which is currently the alleged target of a U.S. NATO bombing campaign under a, quote, counterterrorism mandate, is supported covertly by the United States and its allies. What this means is that the ISIS terrorists are the foot soldiers of the Western alliance. While America claims to be targeting ISIS, in reality, it is protecting ISIS. The air campaign is intent upon destroying Syria and Iraq rather than going after the terrorists. There's lots of evidence that the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, Qatar, and Jordan are behind ISIS, but you won't hear much about that in the controlled media. Here's what author, journalist, and former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under the Reagan administration has to say about the media.
You can't trust the Western media anymore.
And here's what he has to say about ISIS.
Washington has been, until the Paris attacks, very protective of ISIS. Indeed, it's a Washington creation. Washington created it. This has been admitted on television by the former director of the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency, who says flat out, yes, we created ISIS. And Washington, of course, is using ISIS to try to overthrow Assad. So it's hard to see how Washington's agenda can coincide with Russia's. And it's hard to see how France's agenda, if they actually believe ISIS was responsible for the Paris attacks, it's hard to see how France could go along with Washington. And so we see here some potential breakup in NATO, which would be a good thing.
ISIS took credit for the recent Paris attacks. But since we know who's really behind ISIS, what does this really mean? Here's an interview from November 2015 on Russia Today with political journalist and author Geroid O. Kolmain to provide some geopolitical clarity.
Well, let's now talk to political journalist and author Geroid O. Kolmain, who joins us from Paris this evening. Thanks very much for joining us again on RT International. You're in the French capital. What's the mood and atmosphere in the city right now?
We're being told that there's a state of war and a state of emergency. We've had this before. We had this in January, and for several weeks we had nonstop sirens and nonstop chatter on the radio about the threat from radical Islam and terrorist groups and so on. And so we're having a kind of a replay of that, but it has been, I think, accentuated, and we're going to have an intensification of the media campaign, which is essentially a propaganda campaign to make people in France fear Muslims. We need to be clear about the origin of the war on terror. The war on terror is, I quote, orchestrated from abroad. These are the words François Hollande used to describe this terrorist attack. Well, the attacks that have been continuing to destroy Syria, to massacre its population, have also been orchestrated from abroad. They were orchestrated by NATO, and they've been carrying these attacks out against the civilian population of Syria for 4 years now. And this is a terrorist campaign that is also orchestrated from abroad. And people in Europe need to understand that it is becoming global, that is being waged against civilian populations in particular. It is a form of neo-imperialism and neo-colonialism, which aims to divide and conquer European and Middle Eastern and African and the world's population, for that matter, and to make them submit to a global order that does not serve most of the people, that very elite, very small, tiny, and particularly tyrannical ruling elite. There is no war on terror. There is a war that is being waged using proxy groups, terrorist proxy groups, and they are being used against nation states who are resisting U.S. and Israeli hegemony, and they are also being used as a means of disciplining forces in Europe. In a period of mass unemployment and austerity, you now have terrorist attacks being committed by terrorists funded, armed and trained by Western intelligence agencies. There is no such thing as ISIS. ISIS is a creation of the United States. We know that from official sources of the U.S. military themselves. Declassified documents from the intelligence agency have confirmed that. And the French are now, the French government is now attempting to drum up support for more military intervention in Syria. And what they want to do is they want to get in on the game. The game is almost lost. The Russians have routed much of the Islamic State, of Islamic militants coming into Europe disguised as refugees. That will destabilize Central Europe. And the French government wants to get in on the game in Syria and prop up those so-called moderate rebels. There are no moderate rebels, of course, in Syria. There are Al-Qaeda and ISIS militants, terrorists who have been beheading people, eviscerating people, absolutely creating chaos and genocide right across the region, and this does not serve the Syrian people or anyone other than the Western corporate elites and their geopolitical interests.
What do you expect France to do now in the light not only of Friday's terrorism, but 10 months on from Charlie Hebdo? It's not going to ease up on what it's doing, is it?
No. Much depends on how the French public will react. We are being bombarded now with a media propaganda campaign. It's just non-stop talk where we're told not to go out in the street. We're supposed to be fearful and keep quiet and so on. I think there is going to be a campaign against dissidents in France. They're very worried about the new media that has emerged in recent years, and they are very worried about the alternative media. So I think there you will see, we saw this actually after the attacks in January, you will see a conflation of terrorism and dissidents. So one of the tools which the mass media uses to discredit any kind of rational questioning of the established order, and particularly the war on terrorism, is to deride those who would question the war on terrorism as conspiracy theorists. And I think you're going to see a crackdown on so-called conspiracy theorists and websites that actually publish rational and honest analysis of what is happening. So you're going to see more of that type of intellectual terrorism, which is already at boiling point in France. I mean, it's got to the point now where you have professors in universities who are being intimidated. You have school teachers who are basically being fired for even suggesting that there may be a link between French imperialism and terrorism. There was one case recently, for example, of a school teacher who almost lost his job when he suggested there might be a link between French foreign policy and terrorism. So we are going through a period of deep intellectual terrorism. And of course, these random terrorist acts, which are a form of low-intensity civil war, I think that the current crisis, the refugee crisis, which is really a form of coercive engineered migration, because they could have easily have been prevented, this form of coercive engineered migration is going to make this, and it is going to create the conditions of civil war. It is a natural consequence, of course, of globalization, of financial capitalism. It leads to a breakdown of society. And the only way in which they can kind of keep everybody down is by a policy of divide and conquer. So you're going to see a situation where you've got a very much a Wahhabized working class in France. They're being Wahhabized by the allies of the French political elite, the Saudi Qataris. They're building Wahhabite mosques all over the place. And that is going to Wahhabize the youth, and they're going to be then used as pawns, if you like, in much bigger geopolitical wars, proxy wars against Russia, proxy wars against Iran in the Middle East, and so on. And that is going to create massive social unrest. It's going to divide working people against each other. And the only people are going to actually benefit from this are the war contractors, the military industrial media intelligence complex. So in whatever way you look at this, I don't know who exactly did committed this attack and this atrocity, but the real people who are responsible, whether directly or indirectly or consciously or unconsciously, is the French government, because they have been complicit in terrorism in the Middle East and all over Africa. And that needs to be understood. And if we don't understand that, this is going to continue and it's going to deteriorate. We will find ourselves in a situation under military law, martial law, if this continues. So it really needs to be analysed and understood.
Can I pick you up on the issue of migrants and refugees? Because one of the terrorists appears to have been a French citizen, another a recent migrant to the country. What do you think this will do to France's policies towards the migrant crisis?
Well, I think there is sufficient evidence to suggest strongly, in fact, that the current crisis, I mean, the migration crisis is something that is ongoing, and there are different waves. You've got different waves coming up from Libya, you've got the ones coming up from Syria and up through the Balkans. But the current kind of refugee crisis, as it were, is what I would refer to as coercive engineered migration. This is a term used by Kelly Greenhill, a US academic, who wrote an interesting book on this, whereby she shows that migration can be used as a tool by one state to destabilize another state. In this case, it's definitely being used by the United States and Turkey to destabilize the Balkans, Mitteleuropa, which would be Hungary, and of course Germany. And the reason, the geostrategic reasons of this, are basically go back to classical geopolitics, which is Halford McKinder's theory of the world, of dividing the world island. That is to say, you divide the Eurasian Peninsula from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. You create an intermarium there so that you prevent German and Russian unity. And that is why Germany essentially is being kind of overrun with people who are themselves victims of globalization, but they are now being instrumentalized and used as weapons of globalization. And this is one of the key contemporary strategies of US imperialism. You use the consequences of globalization as further tools to further globalization. And I think there is no policy in Europe to control immigration or anything like that. I think that the key question here is not actually controlling immigration. The key question is stopping this geopolitical destabilization of Europe. Some countries are attempting to do that. Hungary is attempting to do that. Bulgaria is attempting to a certain extent to do that. In other words, trying to find out who's an actual refugee and who isn't. They're prioritizing women and children, for example, in Hungary. That's a rational approach. But of course, Viktor Orban of Hungary is being demonized by the European Union for his insistence on implementing the laws of the European Union and of the Hungarian nation state. Here, you're in a situation where the French government is totally subordinate to US dictates. This is a country that has been completely taken over by US imperialism, just as Germany. And France doesn't really have a foreign policy. It does whatever Washington tells it to do.
And again, that was author and political journalist Geroid Okolmane in a November interview on RT. So, we have all of this state-sponsored terrorism being blamed on Muslims to move the U.S. and its allies' political agenda forward. But Russia has entered the picture, and its air support for Syria's fight for survival against ISIS has changed the duplicitous game the West has been playing. The Russians are actually getting rid of ISIS. What's the West to do? Well, for starters, perhaps shoot down some Russian planes and try to make it look like it's actually fighting its own creation, ISIS. Here's part of an article that was posted on the Activist Post on December 2nd, 2015, called U.S. Gives ISIS 45-Minute Warning Before Bombs Runs Out of Ammo Against ISIS Target. And it was written by Brandon Turbeville. And here goes. Ever since the Russians began dropping real bombs on real ISIS targets in Syria, the United States and NATO have been forced to engage in a two-sided propaganda campaign that swears opposition to ISIS while simultaneously doing everything it can to facilitate and protect ISIS forces on the ground. It has also found itself in the bizarre position of trying to facilitate the death squad army while at the same time attempting to play catch-up to the Russians in at least the appearance of bombing ISIS. Thus, when Russian forces truly hit at one of the sources of ISIS funding, the captured oil being shipped from Syria and Iraq to Turkey, where it is purchased by Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan's son, Bilal, the United States must then engage in its own faux bombing campaign against ISIS oil trucks. Yet instead of actually bombing the trucks, drivers and all, and putting them out of commission permanently, the U.S. bombing campaign takes a form of a laughable formality that involves a 45-minute warning to the oil convoys that a U.S. bombing campaign is about to take place. The warning involves an airdrop of leaflets to the tankers that read, "Get out of your trucks now and run away from them. Warning, airstrikes are coming. Oil trucks will be destroyed. Get away from your oil trucks immediately. Do not risk your life." The justification is that the drivers of the tankers might be civilians and not actual ISIS members. Of course, there's no mention of the fact that in any other context, an individual who renders material support to terrorists, particularly in the form of driving tankers of stolen oil in a war zone that will be used to fund the terrorist organization, would be killed without question under that designation. There's also no mention as to why these potential civilians received ample warning, but true civilians received no such courtesy. It is truly a pity that the U.S. did not drop leaflets to the million Iraqis it has killed over the last decade or the thousands of Libyans that died at the hands of NATO. Still, one only need look at the numbers of destroyed oil tankers racked up by the U.S. in comparison to the Russians to see a distinct difference. The United States, according to Colonel Stephen Warren, has taken out only 116 tankers since the bombing campaign began, while the Russians have eliminated over 1,000 in 5 days. Remember, until the Russians began bombing the oil tankers, the United States had yet to launch an attack on them. Even more laughable was the response that came when the U.S. military was questioned as to why they were unable to destroy more trucks than they did after such a highly publicized strategy. According to Army Colonel Steve Warren, the American jets simply ran out of ammo in the process. Quote, "The goal was to destroy every truck there. They ran out of ammunition before they were able to do that. But the desire was to destroy every single truck there," he said. Even with the new attempt to be seen as truly aimed at fighting ISIS in the eyes of the gullible American public, the U.S. has been forced to use videos and photographs from Russian bombings to purvey across the mainstream media due to the fact that American strikes on ISIS oil trucks are so rare. And then here's an article posted on Press TV on November 22, 2015, called "Media Manipulation. U.S. shows footage of Russian airstrike against ISIS as its own." And I'm just going to read you parts of that. So here goes. On November 16, the U.S. military claimed it had destroyed 116 tanker trucks carrying stolen Syrian oil from those fields, but failed to provide video evidence. 2 days later, however, the Russian Air Force destroyed some 500 oil trucks and promptly released footage of the airstrike. On November 19, a program dubbed PBS NewsHour used the Russian footage and passed them off as U.S. airstrikes without revealing the true source. And speaking of lies and the media, I'd like to correct a lie that Donald Trump recently told when he claimed to have watched thousands of Muslims cheering in Jersey City, New Jersey on 9/11. Even CNN said that didn't happen. But what they didn't tell you is that there were actually people cheering in Jersey City on 9/11, but they weren't Muslims. They were five young Israelis in a white moving van who were observed taking photos of themselves in Liberty Park against the smoking ruins of the Twin Towers in the background. They were arrested and released a few months later, and at least two of them were Mossad agents. To learn more about them, just do a search for the dancing Israelis. So all of these wars in the Middle East, falsely justified by the phony war on terror, only made possible by a lying, complicit media, could be ended quickly with the exposure of the truth about 9/11, which proves that Muslim terrorists didn't do it. If you don't already get this, go to ae911truth.org and start your own research. And read Christopher Bolin's book, Solving 9/11. The lives of many people may depend on it. I'll end the show with some quotes by Paul Craig Roberts. And here goes. "The war on terror is a hoax. We don't have to stand for this. We can turn off Fox News, CNN, NPR, and all the rest of the prostitutes who lie for a living. We can cease purchasing the useless newspapers. We can demand that the police spy state that was created entirely on the basis of lies and deceptions be rolled back. Are the American people really such washed-up sheeple, such cowards, that they acquiesce to a police spy state, the foundation of which consists of nothing but lies told by criminals and repeated endlessly by whores pretending to be journalists? If so, the American people are not a people who any longer matter, and they will continue to be treated by Washington and by their local police as people who do not matter. And finally, unless the American people come to their senses and expel the Washington warmongers, war is our future. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Few government policy can have so profound an impact on a nation as immigration. Large numbers of immigrants and their descendants have a significant impact on the cultural, political, and economic situation in their new country. Over the last three decades, socioeconomic conditions and the scourge of war and terror campaigns against the population have caused 25 million people to leave their homelands and immigrate legally to the United States. Additionally, it's estimated that the undocumented population grows by 400,000 to 500,000 each year.
As in the past, immigration has sparked an intense debate over the costs and benefits of such large numbers of people entering the country. One of the central aspects of the immigration debate is its impact on the American economy. Presently, the debate has been controlled by the white nationalist rants of the Republican Party candidates for presidency. But we're about to debunk the myths, counter the lies, repudiate the vitriol, and reset the discussion.
There is a poster that's stayed in my mind's eye for many years. It's a portrait of a Native American, which says, quote, "If you're so against immigration, splendid. When do you intend to leave?" End quote. With us is Dave Disregard Kalik with the Fiscal Policies Institute's Immigration Research Initiative that examines the role of immigrants in the New York State economy and beyond.
And Cal Soto, National Rights Coordinator with the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, ENDALON, committed to improving the lives of day laborers in the United States to protect and expand their civil, labor, and human rights.
So I am amongst a group of people, and someone says something I feel is offensive. And while I know that they're in the wrong and that I could totally engage them and prevail if I were a bit more prepared, to make sure this doesn't happen, how do I respond when someone says increased immigration drives down jobs, drives down wages for low-skilled workers, native-born Americans, and is taking our jobs? And, of course, it's nice to have you, Dave, and Cal with us. So, Dave, let's begin with you. What is the reality? Do immigrants drive down wages for low-skilled workers who were born here? Are they taking those jobs as well?
Thanks for having me, and I'm glad that we're going to have a chance to
kind of reset the conversation. It's a very exciting time in American history, I think. We've had a level of immigration that is rivaling what it was like in the days of Ellis Island. And I think that's been, as it was then, tremendously positive for the U.S. economy, although it also comes with some challenges. I think that what we can see, and there's been a tremendous amount of research that shows, that overall, having immigration is expanding the economy. And it's not bad for U.S.-born workers. In fact, it raises wages a little bit for U.S.-born workers on average. So there's, of course, lots more detail we can go into. And I think that there are some categories of workers that see challenges in, as immigrants are coming in. So I think you do see, I don't think it's a completely made-up question of whether immigrants are affecting the wages of the U.S.-born. But I think what you see is, overall, people are benefiting, U.S.-born people are benefiting. The people who see the most direct competition with immigrants are former immigrants, right? People who came in the last 10 years or so. They're the ones who are seeing a challenge of the new immigrants, and yet they also see benefits of them coming in. So, I think one of the big questions with immigration and labor force outcomes is, how directly are the immigrants coming in, substitutable for the people who are in the labor force? And by and large, the U.S.-born workers have language skills, have social connections, have the ability to move up into supervisory jobs. And that's, I think, largely what we've been seeing as immigrants come into the labor force. So not that there aren't challenges, especially for the immigrants themselves, but I think the overall effect on the economy is very clearly positive. And the overall effect, even on wages of U.S.-born workers, is overall positive.
Let's take a look at the situation of the day laborers. Al, you represent a federation of day labor centers across the country. Why don't you tell us who these workers are, what kinds of jobs they do, and what kind of role the day laborers centers plays? What kind of functions and services do they provide overall?
Yeah, hi, and thanks for having me today. I think I'd like to start just by reiterating what David was saying about new immigrant workers having, in some ways, net benefit on both wages and really labor rights. And so day laborers are workers who work piecemeal jobs. They have different employers every day, work temporary schedules every day, and are sort of picked up generally. You probably know them most by your visits to Home Depot or driving near construction sites where workers are ready and able to do general construction work, general gardening work, or general home kind of cleanup or moving work, right? And so the day laborers here in the country really represent, I think, the bleeding edge of where kind of the rubber meets the road in terms of labor rights. And when they are organized, as we've seen in putting worker center programs together across the country, they really are on the front lines of pushing forward the protection of labor rights. For example, in a lot of cities, we're seeing raise the wage ordinances come about and raising the wage to $15 or somewhere near there. And in the cities where we have strong day labor communities that have been organized, that are fighting already for their own labor rights, they've really led the charge in getting to 15. In Pasadena here, the worker center was actually already at a $15 minimum wage. It's where they start negotiating their price and kind of brought the rest of the city along with them as they pushed for a minimum wage ordinance that was passed just a couple weeks ago. So I think you see not just, this is obviously more anecdotal than the data that David has, but you see that really where the rubber meets the road in terms of labor rights, these workers who are on the front lines, when they are fighting for their labor rights, it benefits the entire community of workers, not just immigrant workers.
If I can jump in, actually, we have seen that in our data as well, that what Cal is saying, that the places where wages are being pushed down is largely where government policies are not adequate, where there's not labor inspection going on sufficiently, where there's not union density to support higher wages, and where those things are in place, immigrants are doing better as well as our U.S.-born workers. So I think it's very much a question of what does the local labor market situation look like and what are the policies and practices around it, and not so much whether they're immigrants or not.
So what is a response from either one or both of you to those people, including well-intentioned, low-wage workers who have bought into the concern that their wages are being pushed down by the influx of immigrant workers, whether legal or undocumented, and or that in various locales they are being transplanted by immigrant workers in their respective jobs. Is this a total... I just want to push the envelope a bit further to be able to respond to, if that were the case even, what should be a meaningful response? Is it kind of going where Cal Soto was saying, well, what we've got to really push for is a living wage amongst all those workers? That's really the issue of pushing wages down. But I am interested in further, both Dave and Cal, how you would view that.
If somebody loses their job or sees their wages declining, it's hard for them to say why exactly that's happening. And very sympathetic to that. That's a widespread phenomenon in the American economy, so it's hard to dismiss that. I think it's a mistake, though, to think that that's happening because of immigration. You know, I think that there are a lot of factors that are creating, you know, giving workers a very hard time in this economy. And there are things that, as Cal was indicating, some of them, things that we can also turn around. I mean, they're largely policy and political decisions as well as organizing practices. But I think that people who are going to say, this is why I've been having a hard time, is because of immigrants, I think quite to the contrary. I think that there are lots of instances where, you know, we see this, I mean, for example, in some of the most struggling cities in this regard, and you look at Detroit and Cincinnati, Cleveland, you know, Pittsburgh, immigration has actually helped those cities to stabilize and grow. That's not people taking jobs from U.S.-born workers. That's people helping to stabilize and expand the local economy in places that are being devastated by forces around the liberal models of globalization and declining minimum wages. And, you know, I think there's sort of a series, deunionization, there's sort of a series of things that are pushing conditions to be worse for those workers. I think immigration is, on average, helping. I think there are some areas where the contrary is happening, too. And so we can talk about that if you want. I don't think that every single area in the country there's and every single, you know, part of the labor force is seeing only benefits. But on average, you see that that's actually a very good thing for the overall economy. And, you know, I think that the question is, how do you make sure that everybody shares in the economic growth that we've had, which has been, in fact, we've had quite a lot of economic growth at the same time. So how do we make sure that all of those workers are sharing in it instead of just some of us?
Cal?
I would just want to add also that, I mean, when we're talking about this, and it is a complex kind of issue, and when you're talking about somebody who's lost their job or experienced, like, their own sort of extreme stress factor in their lives, you're not going to be able to, right, reasonably sit down and try to explain what the economic significance of new immigrant labor is to a city. But I would say that in organizing work, the very real picture is that low-wage workers, no matter where they're from, no matter how new they are to the country, are experiencing a time of difficulty right now and have been for a long time. And what we try to do is paint the very true picture that the labor rights, the problems that are facing, the issues that are facing our immigrant workers and all other low-wage workers, they're connected. They go hand in hand. And if we're trying to think about what we're trying to change, I would just point to the same groups, the large kind of moneyed groups that are funding anti-immigrant rhetoric or funding anti-worker policies. They're the same. They're the same people who will turn around and say, we don't want, we need us to band against new immigrant labor and at the same time continue to push for policies that will hide and keep immigrant labor in the shadows so that they can continue to exploit them for paying less than the minimum wage, not giving appropriate breaks or overtime, very basic, right? And so there's clearly this kind of double speak going on where people are trying to drum up anti-immigrant sentiment and at the same time abuse those immigrant laborers. And the wash is that those same jobs that are apparently being stolen are actually they're being stolen by the employers. They're the ones who are trying to abuse workers in secret without giving the right salaries, without giving the right labor protections. And so I'd like to try to get to a place where we can talk about all workers who are struggling in the country as being a single unified group, which I know is difficult right now.
And Dave, if you can continue this thread of the role that immigrant labor plays in the workplace. And some of what we had discussed is everything from the reality of an aging population born here and what that means for immigrants, and immigrants increasing also the supply of labor. So if you can elaborate on some of those things, the benefits and the importance of immigrant workforce in the economy.
We do have an aging population and immigrants coming in primarily in prime working age. So, you know, are helping to sustain the growth of labor force and the economy. And immigrants coming in just as workers, it's important to understand they're also, as they come here, they start businesses. They're also consumers, and so they're buying more stuff. They're also investors. And so it's not just adding to the labor force. It's also adding to the overall economy, which is why I think you see this very close correlation when you go around the country between economic growth and growth in immigrant share. We did a study some years ago looking at the 25 largest metropolitan areas and saw, you know, the places where the economy is growing are places where there's immigration. The places where the economy is not growing is where there's not much immigration. If your idea is that you're going to see your local economy grow but not have immigrants be part of it, there's basically zero evidence for that being a possibility over the last 25 years of American history.
And Cal, as immigrants are contributing to the economy and working hard, they are also in many places in fear of being imprisoned and deported. Obviously, that's different in different parts of the country. What kind of stories are you hearing? And do you think it's getting worse? And what is the fear if Trump gets elected?
Yeah, I mean, that continues to be an issue, I think, again, tied to the idea that people who have this strong anti-immigrant rhetoric have an interest in creating an underclass, a black market, so to speak, for labor, which is what we don't want. And so ever since, you know, 287G type policies came into place, and these are policies that connected immigration enforcement with local police departments, there has been a fear, legitimate fear from immigrants in the country of their own state-sponsored use of force against them. What happens in practice, right, is that already in a space, for example, in Orange County, where is this type of agreement between the police and immigration enforcement. And we've also seen that there is an incredible anti-immigrant type of sentiment and community there. If somebody does experience some explicit discrimination, somebody is threatened at work, threatened in their homes, if their children are threatened at school, if you're an immigrant and you know that this partnership exists, you're going to feel very uncomfortable going to the people who are paid to protect you, the police. And what we've seen is that makes communities a lot less safe all over the country. It also kind of fosters the ability for this type of hate to grow. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing the result of many years of building sentiment that is against immigrants, building up the case against them, and also building the infrastructure from the state side to kind of create a black hole of police enforcement for that community, a very large community of people in the United States. And that's what we're seeing right now.
And, you know, it's interesting, Dave, that I've seen a lot of reports that come out of your organization that talk about everything from that immigration has a positive effect on high school graduation rates, that immigration to the U.S. actually increases the job prospects for those who were born here, and a number of things like that. So I wonder if you can continue to talk about the significance and the benefit in the economy of immigrant workforce.
Well, one thing that we haven't talked about yet is I think there's good reason for us to be particularly interested in and concerned about what's happening to the low-skilled, lower-wage labor force and how are immigrants integrating there. But mm-hmm. that's actually a small part of the overall picture of immigration. We have an incredibly diverse array of immigrants coming to the United States today. It's about 40 million people. Almost half of them are in white-collar jobs, something that often surprises people. A lot of them in highly educated jobs and professional jobs, but also quite a lot in the middle. A lot of the nurses, a lot of the accountants, a lot of the architects in the country are immigrants. So I think that immigration is, in fact, a much more varied kind of, you know, is much more varied to talk about than I think people often recognize. I think there's very often this equation of, in fact, in the midst of the elections, it always drives me a little crazy to see that people talk about Hispanics and then start to talk about immigration as though, you know, this is the same group. Less than half of immigrants are Hispanic, and less than half of Hispanics are immigrants. So, you know, there are some obvious connections, but it's also nothing like an equation. And in fact, you know, not just all Hispanics coming from Mexico, right? There are also, as you just had somebody from talking about Puerto Rico, but also second generation, third generation from Mexico, but also people from South America, Latin America more broadly, the Caribbean. I think you have a very rich and diverse array of immigrants coming in and helping to expand the overall American economy in ways that's been very positive for the overall economy. I think, as you've explored many times on your show, there are lots of problems with how the benefits of that growth are being distributed. But those are not problems of immigration. Those are problems of maldistribution, of not adequately sharing the wealth that's being created by all of us.
And David, what would be the shock to the economy if Trump were elected and were to deport millions of people, undocumented workers?
Or maybe Hillary Clinton, for that matter. I'm very insecure about what the Democrats, given the role of Obama, have done relevant to policy on the question of immigration.
People have often asked us, I know that there was a powerful show some years back about what would happen if immigrants just disappeared from the American economy. You know, what would be the economic impact if 11 million undocumented people, not to mention, you know, 40 million immigrants altogether, were to disappear? It's just impossible to imagine what that would look like. 11 million people is a, you know, substantial-sized state. It's you know, I don't mean to be provocative, but I can't help thinking my family is Jewish. Like, what did it look like to have the Jews of Europe being pushed out? I mean, it's just not a scale of deportation that anybody could imagine. And I think that Donald Trump, especially, and you know, others as well, have been peddling in this kind of fantasy of, like, let's just send them all somewhere else. That's just not going to happen. So I think what is more realistic is the kind of thing that Cal's been talking about. You know, we have already seen all kinds of areas in which you can have much more aggressive and, you know, hostile kind of enforcement of immigration that can drive people further into desperation and can make things, you know, more and more difficult. And I think we can certainly imagine, you know, we've already seen around the country in different places local laws and ways of trying to make it harder for undocumented immigrants to be here. But I think in the long run, they're still going to be here. It's just a question in what kinds of conditions. And I think that, frankly, if you are concerned about what happens to workers in the low-wage labor market, the last thing you want to do is to make any group of people even more desperate, even more, you know, unable to stand up for their rights. You know, I think that's really a recipe for, you know, for disaster.
Cal Soto, in a few cases, municipalities became directly involved in establishing and operating day labor worker centers. But in many others, there was an effort to eliminate day labor hiring sites, which initially was accomplished by using repressive policing tactics, which then evolved to municipal codes that banned seeking work in public spaces. Where are things at now in your efforts with this national organization to establish effective hiring sites and the relationship to the community? And perhaps you can tell us what some of the other agenda items are that your organization is working on.
Yeah. So what I could say, thankfully, at this point is that it appears that anti-work hailing laws, like the ability to gather and be available for work outside, have been essentially deemed unconstitutional. In every city that has put that type of law in place, we've been successful in reversing that or blocking its implementation. So that's been a great windfall for new immigrants into the country who, in many places, this is the first place that they can find work and be able to support themselves. But the fostering of worker centers, which is our sort of next step in that process, has also kind of grown, expanded. Just last week, we added, I think, our 55th worker center member in Staten Island, La Colmena. the Staten Island Community Job Center. And these centers become not just places to more safely find work and negotiate prices, but they also are places to develop worker skills and develop kind of the community around labor protections, around immigrant protections that create kind of a safety net for workers. To the question of what it might look like for a Donald Trump presidency with Donald Trump-style policies in place, I don't think you have to think too far. You don't have to make anything up. If you visited Arizona in the last 15 years, you can feel and you can see exactly what it would look like throughout the country for immigrant labor to be thrust into the shadows as much as possible, for the state to be putting checkpoints at every major highway, to be searching through cars for immigrants, to be asking for papers. It's created an intensely violent atmosphere in Arizona. In spite of that, the worker centers there, Puente, has been this incredible source of community, of family, and of, you know, workers' rights protection, immigrant rights protection, probably as strong as any worker center, because in the face of that violence, they've banded together, and they needed to in Phoenix. I think that as far as we're looking back right now, seeing how anti-immigrant, anti-immigrant worker policies have kind of faded more and more, we're really happy about how that work has gone. Looking to the future and with the work we're doing now, we really want a strong support of immigrants from the federal government. And we just have yet to have that. Even in 8 years of a Democrat in office, it seemed to only be gotten worse in terms of separating out, parsing out which immigrants are good immigrants, which immigrants are bad immigrants, deporting more immigrants than almost ever before. And utilizing that deportation for offenses that we would not see, that don't really reach the level of expulsion from the country in our eyes, that were never really meant to have that. And so I think you're right. I need to call into question what a Hillary Clinton presidency would look like. If she would continue President Obama's policies, I think we can expect more of this anti-immigrant kind of growing sentiment, because what's happened.
Leave it there, but I certainly, there's never enough time, but this conversation will continue. It is strategic. Yeah. And we certainly know from both of you that protecting labor and civil rights is essential. We both know that enhancing the education of all members of the working class, protecting people with the labor laws and the protection of labor standards, and setting minimum wages and fighting for living wages is really the tasks that are before us. I want to thank Dave Disregard-Kellick with the Fiscal Policy Institute's Immigration Research Initiatives that examines the role of immigrants in New York State economy and beyond, and Cal Soto, National Rights Coordinator with the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, whose organizations face numerous challenges yet are united by a shared mission and common vision that day laborers can be engaged in a civil and social rights movement to recognize their contributions and rights in the U.S. Thank you both for joining us. Stay on the case. We're going to have you back. Many more discussions. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
The Obama administration is bypassing Congress by attempting to rewrite the law and set basic restroom policies, locker room policies, and even shower policies for public and private employers across the country, not just North Carolina.
To the transgender community, the entire Obama administration want you to know that we see you, we stand with you, and we will do everything we can to protect you going forward.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Italy's civil unions law is a glass half full, Tokyo pride peaks as Japan's school bullying surges, and the Obama administration joins U.S. transgender bathroom battles. Those stories and more this week because you discovered This Way Out.
I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending May 14th, 2016. Italy is no longer the last major country in Western Europe without some form of legal recognition for same-gender couples. After several failed attempts to enact a civil unions bill, lawmakers finally voted overwhelmingly on May 11th to create them. Passage fulfilled Prime Minister Matteo Renzi's campaign promise to finally get a civil unions bill for same-gender couples through Parliament. He bravely survived a confidence vote over the issue. Renzi declared it a day of celebration for those who finally feel recognized. Debate over the rights of same-gender couples has raged for several years in Italy. The politically powerful Roman Catholic Church and church-backed conservative lawmakers were able to block earlier versions of a civil unions bill. Church opposition survived in at least a couple of the odd and disappointing provisions of the version that passed this week. One section about faithfulness and fidelity in a civil union was removed over fears that requiring a same-gender couple to be monogamous would be too similar to marriage. Another part that allowed a person to adopt his or her same-gender partner's biological children was also removed. While it was far less than marriage equality, many activists celebrated the bill's passage as a good first step. Not everyone was dancing in the street, however. Maralena Grassadonia of Italy's Rainbow Families Association panned the bill as a monument to the hypocrisy and ineptitude of a political class. This government will go down in history, not for having passed the first law on gay unions, she added, but for having denied children their family rights. The Roman Catholic Church called the new law creeping fascism.
Bermuda's government has announced a date for its pending referendum on marriage equality and civil unions. June 23rd. Voters on the island nation will be asked two questions. Are you in favor of same-sex marriage in Bermuda? And are you in favor of same-sex civil unions in Bermuda? According to the local Royal Gazette newspaper, a coalition of groups including the Rainbow Alliance, Marriage Equality Bermuda, Same Love Bermuda, and the newly registered charity Out Bermuda will be pushing a double yes vote. Preserve Marriage Treasurer Mark Hall, a youth minister for Word of Life Church, described his group as an umbrella organization for those against any legal recognition of same-gender couples. He said that their Double No campaign was likely to focus on paid media advertising. Prime Minister Michael Dunkley told a press conference this week that the referendum results would be non-binding. He said the vote was an opportunity for government and for the people of Bermuda to express their opinions on a very important subject.
The pending marriage equality referendum in Australia is also non-binding. But it will only happen if the current Liberal National Coalition government maintains its parliamentary majority in the upcoming national elections. The opposition Labour Party and its Green allies are almost certain to pass a marriage equality bill if they win a majority in Parliament. That would also save the estimated $160 million cost of the referendum. A solid majority of Australians support marriage equality in virtually every public opinion poll. Most expect that the referendum results would reflect that support. National elections have been scheduled for July 2nd.
In other news, Tokyo's 6th annual Rainbow Pride Parade on May 8th was the biggest ever. A two-day fair that began the day before included booths staffed by many Japanese and Japan-based international companies. According to organizers, some 70,000 people attended the weekend fair and parade, the largest turnout in the event's history. Though they surely didn't intend to rain on the parade, Human Rights Watch released a report earlier in the week charging that systematic discrimination and bullying against LGBT students is rampant in Japan's public schools. It ranges from hostile verbal abuse to violent physical assaults, and the report accused teachers and other school officials of turning a blind eye to the problem. HRW researcher Kyle Knight urged the Japanese government to incorporate sexual and gender minorities into its bullying policy, which is currently under review.
Transgender people were front and center this week in the United States. It began with dueling press conferences on May 9th by North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory and U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch over the state's now infamous HB2. The law bans local governments from protecting their LGBT citizens from discrimination, but it's been described as a bathroom bill because it also requires trans students to use sex-segregated campus facilities that match the gender on their birth certificate. And before the week was up, the Obama administration told U.S. public schools to allow transgender students to use the campus bathrooms and other facilities in which they feel most comfortable. Federal funding could be on the line if school officials refuse to follow the guidelines issued by the Department of Education. The Department of Health and Human Services also issued new rules confirming that LGBT people are protected against healthcare discrimination under the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The directive says that transgender people in particular must be provided with transition-related services and can't be denied health care by providers or professionals who receive federal funding.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest told reporters during a press briefing at week's end that no federal funding would be withheld from states that do not follow the directives until lawsuits involving North Carolina's so-called bathroom bill and similar state laws are resolved. Conservative politicians, mostly in the South, including North Carolina's Governor Pat McCrory, of course, condemned the Obama administration's aggressive pro-trans actions. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick called it blackmail from the President of the United States and said that we will not sell out our children to the federal government. Governor Phil Bryant of Mississippi, which has its own anti-LGBT religious freedom law, said the new guidelines are the most outrageous example yet of the Obama administration forcing its liberal agenda on states that roundly reject it. Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas ordered schools in his state to disregard the directive, which he called social engineering. Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin said that it is difficult to imagine a more absurd federal overreach into a local issue. And Tennessee State Representative Susan Lynn wrote on her Facebook page that no one should be forced to entertain another's mental disorder.
6 in 10 Americans, however, are opposed to anti-transgender bathroom bills. That's the finding of a new CNN-sponsored public opinion poll released on May 9th. 57% of the 1,001 respondents expressed opposition to laws that require transgender people to use bathrooms that don't correspond to their gender identity. Most said they had a family member or close friend who's gay or lesbian, and 14% said they were close with someone who's transgender. 38% said they supported such legislation. Democrats and independents were more likely to oppose the transphobic laws, but Republicans were almost evenly split on the issue. About 75% of respondents favored laws guaranteeing equal protection for transgender people in jobs, housing, and public accommodations. 80% were in favor of such protections for lesbian and gay people. The poll was conducted between April 28th and May 1st, before this week's major pro-transgender developments. CNN said the margin of error was plus or minus 3 percentage points. Despite efforts that began more than 4 decades ago, federal lawmakers still lag behind public opinion. The latest version of a bill to ban anti-LGBT bias currently languishes in the Republican-controlled Congress.
But finally, corporate America and major professional organizations have come to the defense of LGBT people in record numbers in several states that have considered or have already passed discriminatory laws. A faith-based convention planned for Nashville, Tennessee, has been moved out of the volunteer state because of its recently enacted law allowing counselors and therapists to deny service to LGBT people based on sincerely held principles, a less than subtle type of so-called religious freedom bill. The Colorado-based Centers for Spiritual Living expected more than 500 people at its three-day convention in February. The group's announcement to move their event out of Tennessee came just a day after the 55,000-member American Counseling Association said it was moving its 2017 conference out of Nashville because of the Tennessee law. More than 3,000 mental health professionals are expected to attend. Richard Yep, chief executive officer of the ACA, explained the organization's decision to relocate their 2017 conference and expo in a YouTube-posted video.
Of all the state legislation impacting counseling during my 30 years with ACA, the new Tennessee law based on Senate Bill 1556, House Bill 1840, is the worst. HB 1840 allows counselors to deny services to LGBTQ clients and others in clear violation of the American Counseling Association's Code of Ethics. No other state has a law like Tennessee's. If the new law is allowed to stand, we cannot in good conscience bring business to Tennessee. It is an affront to our profession, and we must stand firm to prevent other states from enacting a law like HB 1840. Therefore, our annual meeting will be rescheduled for another venue outside of Tennessee.
That's Richard Yep of the American Counseling Association.
And that's News Wrap for the week ending May 14th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Abby Deese.
There's more queer news out of North Carolina, and it's almost always something these days. Dueling bathroom lawsuits were exchanged on May 9th. 4 days later, the Obama administration issued groundbreaking guidelines advancing the rights of transgender Americans. This week's update begins with reports by Pacifica Radio's Mark Miracle and Nell Abram of Free Speech Radio News.
A potentially epic clash over transgender rights took shape today when the U.S. Justice Department sued North Carolina over the state's bathroom law after the governor refused to back down. Billions of dollars in federal aid for North Carolina and a potentially landmark decision regarding the reach of the nation's civil rights laws are at stake in the dispute, which in recent weeks has triggered boycotts and cancellations aimed at pressuring the state into repealing the measure. Last week, the Justice Department said the law amounts to illegal sex discrimination and gave Governor Pat McCrory until today to say he would refuse to enforce it. When the deadline arrived, a defiant McCrory instead sued the federal government.
Our nation is dealing with a very new, complex, and emotional issue. How to balance the expectations of privacy and equality in one of the most private areas of our lives, restrooms, locker rooms, or public shower facilities. No one in North Carolina was talking about bathroom policy until the Charlotte City Council imposed a mandate on private businesses. This mandate required, with potential penalty of fine, access to restrooms, locker rooms, or shower facilities be based upon one's gender identity or gender expression. A similar policy was rejected just months earlier by the voters of Houston, Texas, by 61% of the vote. This caused major privacy concerns about males entering female facilities or females entering male facilities. Our state legislature believed this was an unnecessary government overreach. The state legislature and this governor also believed that guidelines then needed to be put in place because of this new public topic. Now, just 5 days ago, the U.S. Department of Justice sent letters to my office
the Department of Public Safety, which reports to this governor, and to the university system, suggesting that having government employees use the bathroom, locker room, or shower facility that corresponds to their biological sex is in conflict with federal policy. The Department of Justice asked all parties to set aside their constitutional duty and refuse to follow or enforce our state law. And the U.S. government gave us a mere 3 business days to respond to this letter. I do not agree with their interpretation of federal law. That is why this morning I have asked a federal court to clarify what the law actually is. Because this is not just a North Carolina issue. This is now a national issue and an issue which imposes new law on every private sector employer throughout the United States of America with over 15 employees. And let me say something. Our nation is one nation, especially when it comes to fighting discrimination, which I support wholeheartedly. Ultimately, I think it's time for the U.S. Congress to bring clarity to our national anti-discrimination provisions under Title VII and Title IX. Now, right now, the Obama administration is bypassing Congress by attempting to rewrite the law and set basic restroom policies, locker room policies, and even shower policies for public and private employers across the country, not just North Carolina. And I want to ensure the people of our state and our country that North Carolina has long held traditions of ensuring equality. The majority of our citizens in our great state and this governor did not seek out this issue. However, the state of North Carolina and this governor welcomed the opportunity to be part of the solution for all of the states and especially our nation, the greatest nation, the United States of America. Thank you very much.
Governor Pat McCrory, I'm Mark Miracle. More from Free Speech Radio News' Nell Abram.
North Carolina lawmakers introduced, passed, signed, and enacted HB 2 over the course of a single day in March. Supporters say the bill is not aimed at discriminating against transgender individuals, but rather to protect girls from sexual predators disguising themselves as females to gain entry to public restrooms. Opponents reject this claim, noting there are no such incidents on record. Attorney General Loretta Lynch says this bill goes far beyond determining who can use which restroom.
We are here to announce a significant law enforcement action regarding North Carolina's Public Facilities Privacy and Security Act. The North Carolina General Assembly passed House Bill 2 in special session on March 23rd of this year. The bill sought to strike down an anti-discrimination provision in a recently passed Charlotte, North Carolina ordinance, as well as to require transgender people in public agencies to use the bathrooms consistent with their sex as noted at birth, rather than the bathrooms that fit their gender identity. The bill was signed into law that same day. And in so doing, the legislature and the governor placed North Carolina in direct opposition to federal laws prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sex and gender identity. More to the point, they created state-sponsored discrimination against transgender individuals who simply seek to engage in the most private of functions in a place of safety and security, a right taken for granted by most of us. But this morning, the state of North Carolina and its governor chose to respond by suing the Department of Justice. Today, we are filing a federal civil rights lawsuit against the state of North Carolina, Governor Pat McCrory, the North Carolina Department of Public Safety, and the University of North Carolina. We are seeking a court order declaring HB 2's restroom restriction impermissibly discriminatory, as well as a statewide bar on its enforcement. Now, while the lawsuit currently seeks declaratory relief, I want to note that we retain the option of curtailing federal funding to the North Carolina Department of Public Safety and the University of North Carolina as this case proceeds.
But this action is about a great deal more than bathrooms. This is about the dignity and the respect that we accord our fellow citizens and the laws that we as a people and as a country have enacted to protect them, indeed to protect all of us. And it's about the founding ideals that have led this country, haltingly but inexorably, in the direction of fairness, inclusion, and equality for all Americans. This is not the first time that we have seen discriminatory responses to historic moments of progress for our nation. We saw it in the Jim Crow laws that followed the Emancipation Proclamation. We saw it in the fierce and widespread resistance to Brown v. Board of Education. And we saw it in the proliferation of state bans on same-sex unions that were intended to stifle any hope that gay and lesbian Americans might one day be afforded the right to marry. And that right, of course, is now recognized as a guarantee embedded in our Constitution. And in the wake of that historic triumph, we have seen bill after bill and state after state taking aim at the LGBT community. And what we must not do, what we must never do, is turn on our neighbors, our family members, our fellow Americans for something that they cannot control and deny what makes them human. And this is why none of us can stand by when a state enters the business of legislating identity and insists that a person pretend to be something or someone that they are not, or invents a problem that does not exist as a pretext for discrimination and harassment. And let me speak now directly to the people of the great state, the beautiful state, my home state of North Carolina. You have been told that this law protects vulnerable populations from harm, but that is just not the case. Instead, what this law does is inflict further indignity on a population that has already suffered far more than its fair share. This law provides no benefit to society, and all it does is harm innocent Americans. And instead of turning away from our neighbors, our friends, and our colleagues, let us instead learn from our history and avoid repeating the mistakes of our past. And let us reflect on the obvious but often neglected lesson that state-sanctioned discrimination never looks good and never works in hindsight. It was not so very long ago that states, including North Carolina, had other signs above restrooms, water fountains, and on public accommodations, keeping people out based on a distinction without a difference. We've moved beyond those dark days, but not without a tremendous amount of pain and suffering and an ongoing fight to keep moving forward. Let us write a different story this time. Let us not act out of fear and misunderstanding, but out of the values of inclusion and diversity and regard for all that make our country great. And let me also speak directly to the transgender community itself. Some of you have lived freely for decades, and others of you are still wondering how you can possibly live the lives that you were born to live, to lead. But no matter how isolated, no matter how afraid, and no matter how alone you may feel today, know this, that the Department of Justice, and indeed the entire Obama administration, want you to know that we see you, we stand with you, and we will do everything we can to protect you going forward. And please know that history is on your side. This country was founded on the promise of equal rights for all. And we have always managed to move closer to that ideal, little by little, day by day. And it may not be easy, but we will get there together.
That's Attorney General Loretta Lynch. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
Good evening. It's Friday, May 13th. From Pacifica Radio, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, this is the Evening News with Glenn Reeder. I'm Mark Miracle. The Obama administration announced today that public schools must permit transgender students to use bathrooms and locker rooms consistent with their gender identity. The Justice and Education Departments jointly issued the directive. The guidance does not impose any new legal requirements, but officials say it's meant to clarify expectations of school districts that receive funding from the federal government.
The guidance comes days after the Justice Department and the state of North Carolina filed dueling lawsuits over a new state law that says transgender people must use public bathrooms, showers, and changing rooms that correspond to the sex on their birth certificate. The administration has said that law violates the Civil Rights Act. Politicians in Texas, Arkansas, and elsewhere vowed defiance, and other conservative states could follow suit. Texas says it can do without the billions of dollars it receives in federal school funding. The state's lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, says Texas will not yield to blackmail and urged superintendents to defy the new federal guidelines.
The federal government's guidance was met with praise from parents of transgender students at the Transgender Law Center in San Francisco. Legal Director Elena Turner called it the big step forward.
Inclusive policies that make clear that transgender students can't be discriminated against, that they will be treated like everyone else, that sends a message that transgender students are entitled to respect and that the school is a welcoming environment. Unfortunately, many people still don't understand what it means to be transgender, and there's a lot of education that still needs to be done.
The Liberty Council, a group claiming to promote religious freedom, denounces the directive as a lawless act, which only works through an implicit threat. Matt Stable, the founder of the Liberty Council, says transgender people are mentally ill.
This is not normal for a man to think that he is a woman trapped in a man's body. It doesn't require the forcing of opening up restrooms and locker rooms and shower rooms to people of the opposite sex. There should be other intervention for those individuals that have this kind of mental stress or dysphoria or disconnect.
Matt Stable, the founder of the Liberty Council. Schools across the country will have to implement the directive within the next few weeks. Although the consequences for not doing so are not yet clear, the government's directive is expected to be challenged in court.
That report by Mark Miracle and Glenn Reeder of Pacifica Radio News. A companion directive was issued by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services on May 13th. Confirming that transgender citizens are fully covered by President Obama's Affordable Care Act and are entitled to all medical services under the act, including transition-related care. Meanwhile, a veritable chorus of law enforcement officials are calling North Carolina's HB2 virtually unenforceable. Asheville Police Department Public Information Officer Christina Hollingsay told National Public Radio that the legislation not only fails to include any penalties, it would seem to require officers to stand guard outside restrooms and other gender-segregated public facilities, checking people's birth certificates, taking police away from genuine public safety duties. All this wrangling has certainly thrust the issue into public consciousness. Reference book publisher Merriam-Webster said searches for the word transgender in its online dictionary surged 630% soon after news broke about the Obama administration's pro-trans directives. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Abby Dees and Michael LeBeau contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride and to Mark Miracle and Glenn Reeder of Pacifica Radio News and Nell Abram of Free Speech Radio News. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For associate producer Alicia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on kwtf.net, Bodega Bay, California, WBSU, Brockport, New York, South Ribble Community Radio, Lancashire, England, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on listener-supported Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Did the 20th century have to be the century of U.S. empire? That's a question posed by Oliver Stone, the three-time Academy Award-winning filmmaker, in a remarkable DVD collection known for such films as Born on the 4th of July and Wall Street. Stone has created a gripping antidote to the myths of U.S. power. It's a 12-hour documentary series called The Untold History of the United States. Stone co-wrote, directed, produced, and narrated it. Historian Peter Kuznick co-wrote the series, as well as a companion book of the same name. Kuznick is professor of history at American University, and today we'll present excerpts from the 12-part documentary series, a series that journalist Glenn Greenwald has said he cannot recommend highly enough. The Untold History of the United States, as a DVD box set, is your thank you gift for a pledge of $175 or $14 and change per month over 12 months to this listener-sponsored radio station. And the phone number here is 1-800-439-5732. Easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge online at kpfa.org. We've also got a fabulous combo pack on offer this hour, the 12-hour DVD box set of The Untold History of the United States, plus Capitalism, the six-part, five-hour documentary film series on DVD that we featured on this program last week and has been featured on a number of other time slots during this KPFA Spring Fund Drive. So you get both The Untold History of the U.S. and Capitalism, the six-part documentary film series on DVD, both, for a pledge of $1 a day to KPFA. That's $365, which you can break down into installments. Just talk to the phone room. People are waiting for your call at 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-439-KPFA. Now, Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick spoke at Left Forum on a panel moderated by Bill Fletcher. Today, we'll bring you highlights of that discussion, but we'll begin with a clip from the beginning of the film, The Untold History of the United States.
Hello, I'm Oliver Stone. When I was a young boy growing up in New York City, I thought I received a good education. I studied history extensively, especially American history. Made sense. We were the center of the world. There was a manifest destiny. We were the good guys. Well, I've traveled the world now. I continued my education as an infantryman in Vietnam. Made a lot of movies, some of them about history. And I've learned a lot more than I once knew. And when I heard from my children what they were learning at school, I was perturbed to hear that they were not really getting a more honest view of the world than I did. Much of our lives in a fog, but I would like my children to have access to something that looks beyond what I call the tyranny of now. You watch the media, everyone talks about that thing, the news of the day, and all the subconscious, really important stuff that's going on is being neglected. Napoleon once said that history is a pack of lies agreed upon. Well, I'm not sure I agree. History does have a meaning, does have a purpose, and there is a pattern to be found. And I wanted, with my colleagues, rather than make another feature film, to tell the American story in a way that has never been told before. There are many questions that you may not find answered here, but you will find questions raised that I hope will help make you more conscious. We are going to propose, among other things, a forgotten set of heroes. People who suffered for their beliefs and who have been lost to history because they did not conform. And we are going to debunk some of those heroes that you believe in, not with malice, but by restating the facts. Unless we remind ourselves of the good that we have lost, it's not easy to imagine a better future. By showing you the patterns of behavior which have come to be that you perhaps have not noticed before, we'll try to bring you back to the meaning of this country and what so radically changed after World War II. There have been some profound mistakes, but we still have a chance, I strongly believe, to correct them.
Good evening. Oliver, Peter, good evening. When I saw this documentary, I was sitting at home with my wife and my mouth dropped and I said, Candace, this is like on mainstream television. Am I missing something? And what inspired this? I mean, where did this documentary come from?
You know, I grew up conservative and I grew up Republican. My father was on Wall Street and I went to Vietnam in the belief they were fighting communists. So I'm probably a little bit different from most of you. And Peter was protesting the nuclear bomb way back in the 50s probably, and then he was protesting the Vietnam War. So I reached a place in my life, to make a long story short, Greg Wilpert just summed it up very nicely, but when I did Salvador, when I went to Central America with Boyle in the 1980s, I was, let's say, I became progressively enlightened after my experience in Vietnam, but I was seeing Vietnam redux. I was seeing the same behavior, the desire to repress the poor, the reform candidates, the labor teachers, nuns. It was Reagan's policy supporting the dictators there and the death squads that started to happen in Salvador and Honduras and the Contra and Guatemala, of course, and the Contra war against Nicaragua. It was Vietnam Redux, and I saw the whole thing and I said, "Wow, I got to do something more in my life than make movies like Midnight Express and Scarface." So basically, I took another tack and I did Salvador, which made very little money and very little, but it made some impact. And I found out that America's interest in Latin America is very minimal. Americans don't go to movies about it. That's just a fact, documentary or fiction. But I made it anyway, and I'm very happy with the result. Very proud of that film. But then I kept... Thank you. We can talk more about Latin America later in your questions, but I kept trying to make progressive films, and I got more and more with Vietnam, Wall Street, JFK, Nixon. I got more and more research done in my life. I met more and more people, and obviously you evolve. So my life is really about evolution. And I reached this place when George Bush was in office for that second four-year term, when I was just had enough. It was up to here. I said, I can't go on making only movies, because I know too much now. I've seen too much in my lifetime. I grew up under the atomic bomb, the shadow of it, which is where I wanted to start this thing. So I wanted to go back with the remainder of a time and energy that I had left and really do a documentary, because I've been accused endlessly of distorting the truth in my dramatic histories. So I wanted to go back and do it documentary style, with fact checks, which we did three of, and put it all down from 1900 to now. We actually have 12 hours, which was going to come out on DVD in October. This is a story of the mask coming off, and this is the way I see it, and Peter sees it, because Peter and I had been friends since 1996, and he told me, I was very fascinated by the atomic bomb, the real story, because I'd always accepted the cop-out that the United States had to drop the bomb, that World War II ended triumphantly because we dropped the bomb, etc. So Peter told me this incredible story about not just the bomb, but the origins of that Henry Wallace story that seeds back to 1944, and you have to think about the possibilities if Wallace had been elected.
And when in 1996, over dinner, after Oliver came to my class, I laid out this vision. I said, "Oliver, this is an idea for a movie that you've got to make at some point." And I talked about how close Henry Wallace came to being back on the ticket as vice president, and what would have happened if Wallace, who was the most radical man ever to get close to the presidency, had become president in 1945 when Roosevelt died instead of Truman. That opened up all kinds of new vistas. And we weren't able to make the feature film back then, but we kept on talking about this over the years. We stayed friends. And then in 2007, we're having dinner in D.C., and Oliver says, "Let's do it. Let's do a documentary." And at that point, we thought, at least for a few minutes, we were going to do one 60 or 90-minute documentary about Henry Wallace and the atomic bombing, the origins of the Cold War. By the time I went to see Oliver 2 weeks later in New York to map it out, Oliver said, "No, let's do a 10-part, 10-hour documentary film series." So I was on sabbatical. I thought this was going to take maybe a year and then it would be over. We worked on this almost nonstop for 5 years. And we ended up doing 12 episodes. When we released the box set in October, and Warner Brothers is going to do it at the least as inexpensively as possible, because we want a mass audience for this, we're going to show all 12 episodes in the box set, which includes our work that takes back to the late 19th century and goes through the origins of World War II, because that period is very, very important also. But most of this is going to start, as you see here, with World War II and with the atomic bomb. The first episode is really about World War II.
Thank you. The Sangre de Cristo, or Blood of Christ, mountain range is one of the United States' most remote and primitive landscapes. In an isolated ranch house, the world's top scientists, many of them European, gather nervously in the chill morning air. Nearby, in the darkness, something hangs atop a steel tower. A bomb. Today, they will test it. The test is codenamed Trinity. The inspiration, John Donne, Robert Oppenheimer's favorite poet. One of the premier scientists of his age, Oppenheimer loved literature in the desert of the Southwest. He was a peaceful man who just happened to have created and coordinated the most destructive weapon in all history. Only a few miles away, the project's military commander, Brigadier General Leslie Groves, is the man responsible for building the War Department's gigantic new headquarters in Virginia, known as the Pentagon. He doesn't like relying on unreliable civilian scientists. His career is on the line.
Here it is, General Groves. Plutonium.
That's the first time I've seen it. If you don't mind, I wish you'd hold that under it, because after all, there's about $50 million in that test. The
automatic controls got it now. Robert, this time the stakes are really high.
It's going to work all right, Robert. And I'm sure we'll never be sorry for it.
In 40 seconds, we'll know.
In the last few minutes, general silence is observed as the countdown begins. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. In 5:29 and 45 seconds, the bomb detonates. The light is brighter than the sun. Observing the explosion, Oppenheimer recalls a line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
This terrifying weapon would launch the United States on a journey, turning the refuge of the founding fathers into a militarized state.
Excerpts from The Untold History of the United States. It's a 12-part, 12-hour documentary film series, and it is yours in a DVD box set, a very handsome DVD box set, as a thank you gift for a pledge of just $175 to KPFA. $175 pledge, it's less than $15 a month, and you get this amazing documentary film series, 12 parts, 12 hours, directed and narrated by Oliver Stone, co-written with Peter Kuznick, 1-800-439-5732. Toll free, 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We've had a couple people already donate on kpfa.org. You can pledge securely online there at kpfa.org. And we have a fabulous combo pack, which includes the box set, the DVD box set of this documentary film series, The Untold History of the United States, plus Capitalism, which is a six-part, five-hour documentary series, which we featured last week, in which thinkers like Noam Chomsky, David Graeber, and Thomas Piketty examine and critique the ideas of Adam Smith, Karl Marx, John Maynard Keynes, and many others. So you get those two box sets, Untold History of the United States and Capitalism, for a dollar a day to KPFA. A dollar a day over a year to KPFA gets you this fabulous, ultra-discounted thank you gift, Capitalism plus what we are featuring today, the Untold History of the United States. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. I'm CS. Sasha Lilly is my colleague and co-host, and we are so delighted today to bring you the opportunity to get this 12-part documentary series, which has been praised up and down by so many folks, I can't even tell you, and for good reason. I mean, this is Oliver Stone's most ambitious film project ever. It took something like 4 years to complete, and they aired 10 of the one-hour episodes on TV, and then they added two more just for the DVD box set that is yours for a pledge of $175 to KPFA. Usually we offer a single DVD, you know, a film of maybe an hour and a half, for a $100 pledge of support. What I'm telling you is that for a $175 pledge of support, you get 12 hours, a 12-part documentary film series in a DVD box set. Again, Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick coming together to put this incredible untold history. The emphasis is on untold history that all of us need to know and most of us don't. You get this to listen, to watch, and to enjoy and to learn from for quite some time. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And by the way, there is a companion book, and it's really kind of an amazing book. It's almost 800 pages. And if you like to read, you can get the book plus the DVDs of the Untold History of the U.S. You get the film series and the book for a discounted rate of just over $20 a month over a period of 12 months. Give the phone volunteers a call. Ask them. They'll be happy to help you. It'll take just a couple minutes of your time, and you'll have contributed, and you'll have gotten something really kind of amazing. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. The next excerpt from this film series called The Untold History of the United States that I'd like to play for you looks at U.S. foreign policy, and you'll recognize the voices of John F. Kennedy and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's then followed by a discussion between Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick with Bill Fletcher moderating.
Let us never fear to negotiate.
These Germans escaped by the tens of thousands until the communists threw up their wall of hate.
The assault has begun on the dictatorship of Fidel Castro.
This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? If America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift, is approaching spiritual death. This need to maintain social stability for our investments accounts for the counter-revolutionary action of American forces in Guatemala. It tells why American helicopters are being used against guerrillas in Cambodia, and why American napalm and green beret forces have already been active against rebels in Peru. They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. My questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghetto without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
I want to actually go back prior to the events that are covered here on this particular clip, because the scariest episode for me was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and one of the things that you convey is that there have been several moments when we've been on the verge of nuclear war. And I can remember as a kid the fear that I felt at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I was very young, but the fear was everywhere. And I would appreciate it if you could take us through what exactly happened. What is it that most people do not understand about the Cuban Missile Crisis?
You do it quickly.
The Cuban Missile Crisis, where people have a sense how close we came to actual war, but they don't really know the details of it, which we've been finding out lately from some of the documents that have been released. And the scariest moment, which Schlesinger said was not only the scariest moment of this crisis, but the scariest moment in all human history, was when U.S. ships were dropping depth charges on a Soviet submarine that was approaching the blockade line, and the power went out in the Soviet submarine. The carbon dioxide was rising. Sailors were fainting. The officers were fainting, passing out. The chief officer says, the war must have started already. We're down here doing somersaults. We should launch our nuclear torpedo. The Americans had no idea that they had nuclear weapons on this submarine that we were knocking out down there. So they gave the order to launch. Fortunately, the sub commander said, talked him out of launching. Had he not talked him out of launching, then, and his name was Arkhipov. This man named Arkhipov, who was unknown to history, single-handedly prevented nuclear war from starting that day. Had they launched, the United States would have retaliated with nuclear weapons, and much of the world as we know it probably wouldn't be here now. So that was about the scariest moment, but that was not known to the public. Even what was known to the public, the pressure on Kennedy to invade Cuba was enormous. The entirety of his Joint Chiefs of Staff were pushing him to do it. All of his advisors were pushing him to do it. Even people like Sorensen and Robert at one point were encouraging a U.S. surgical strike followed by an invasion. Had we done that, we were completely ignorant of what was going on there. We didn't know that the weapons were there, that they were installed, that they were ready to launch. We didn't know where they were. We didn't know how many there were. And what we really didn't know was that there were battlefield nuclear weapons, 100 battlefield nuclear weapons also. Initially, McNamara said we would lose maybe 1,800 people. Then when he found out some more of the details, that there were three times as many armed Cubans and four times as many armed Russian Soviet soldiers there, then he said we would have lost 25,000 people in an invasion. When he found out that they had 100 battlefield nuclear weapons, McNamara almost passed out 30 years later. And he says, if we had invaded, we would have lost 100,000 men. We would have wiped out Cuba and very likely the Soviet Union also. And so that's how close we came. We were acting out of ignorance, as we often do in these situations. And what Kennedy and Khrushchev both learned from this is that these kind of crises cannot be controlled. There was that, even though both of them were doing everything they could to avoid confrontation and war there, they both concluded that there was no way to control a crisis like this. So Khrushchev contacts Kennedy and says, we have to eliminate every possible conflict that can lead to another confrontation like this. And Kennedy and Khrushchev, from late 1962, through Kennedy's assassination, did everything they could both to roll back on all of these crises and to end the Cold War. So our interpretation of Kennedy in the last year is very different than the Kennedy who in the 1950s as a senator and the Kennedy the first 2 years of his administration when he remained a Cold War hawk. But Kennedy learned something that most American presidents, like Barack Obama, have not learned, how dangerous this situation is and the folly of this kind of confrontation when you've got people armed to the teeth in this kind of world.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Let's return now to excerpts from the discussion between Oliver Stone, Peter Kuznick, and Bill Fletcher, talking about whether Henry Wallace, had he remained vice president under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and continued in that position after FDR died, would have been the most progressive president in U.S. history.
It's amazing how quick it goes. If Roosevelt had lived three more months, the whole world would be a different shape. If Wallace had become president in April 45, the whole world would be different. It's amazing how the curve of the ball breaks sometimes. But that was pure bad luck the way he died.
Yeah, I want to pursue this point that you're just making, Oliver, because at different points, you do highlight the role of certain individuals, Roosevelt, Wallace, etc. But my question is, are you putting too much on these individuals? I mean, in other words, I think that the record is fairly clear in terms of Wallace, what Wallace, Henry Wallace stood for. But there are other factors that are at play when these individuals get into office. And had Wallace been elected president or taken over as vice president or been elected in 48, why should we believe that things would have fundamentally changed? I mean, what I wondered in watching this is, this is one vicious country. This is a vicious country. And we know that in the 1930s, there was a plot to overthrow Roosevelt, trying to enlist Smedley Butler and veterans. It seems to me that in the middle of the Cold War, it could something very similar could have happened. So, but in any case, I mean, what is it that leads you to believe that these individuals would ultimately have made that much of a difference in terms of where we ended up?
Well, there's no way to know. You know, we can't say for sure what would have happened had Wallace become president instead of Truman. As we show, Wallace came extraordinarily close to getting to be back on the ticket as vice president in 1944. In fact, he was the second most popular man in America. Even though he called for the century of the common man, he called for worldwide people's revolution, he denounced America's fascists, who he said were those Wall Street interests who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second. Now we call them Democrats and Republicans. He had a very radical vision. But he was enormously popular because the country was more progressive then. We were fighting a war against fascism and German and Japanese militarism. Gallup released a poll on July 20th, 1944, the start of the Democratic Convention, that asked potential voters who they wanted on the ticket as vice president. 65% said they wanted Henry Wallace as vice president. 2% said they wanted Harry Truman. But the convention was stacked. But Wallace gave the seconding speech for Roosevelt that opening night. The place went wild, even though the party bosses thought they had it controlled. 45-minute demonstration led by people like Hubert Humphrey and Adlai Stevenson. And in the middle of that, Claude Pepper, the senator from Florida, nicknamed Red Pepper because of his politics, makes his way up to the microphone, knowing if he could get Wallace's name and nomination that night, he'll sweep the convention and be back on the ticket as vice president. Pepper got literally 5 feet from the microphone when the bosses managed to adjourn the convention that night. And so that's how close we came. Had Wallace gotten in there, he could have stopped the atomic bombing. He could have done that on his own authority, and we know that he would have done that, or we know as much as we can know anything. Could he have stopped the Cold War? That's a different question. As you're saying, there are structural forces in place. But 1945 was not like today. 1945, we were a much more progressive country. 1945, the Soviets were our allies. They were lionized for having just won World War II. They were the ones the reason why the British weren't speaking German was because of the Soviet Union. And people understood that at that point. So I think he could have certainly resisted the kind of Cold War we had and very likely changed it.
Excerpts from this magisterial alternative history of the United States. It's called Untold History of the United States. I'm CS with Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on listener-supported KPFA. And I want to let you know again about, we're going to return to more of the film and of that discussion, but I want to let you know again how you can get as your very own this 12-part, 12-hour documentary film series in a handsome DVD box set at a very discounted rate, because these 12 hours are available to you for a $175 one-year pledge to KPFA. That's less than $15 a month, and the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-439-KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can donate online at kpfa.org. And in the next 4 minutes, we have been given a match, and that match is from Melvin in Walnut Creek, California. Thanks so much, Melvin. And he's put up $200, which means he'll double your money, your contribution of $25, $60, $100, $175. He'll double anybody's contribution collectively up to $200, but only for the next 4 minutes. So if you call and you want the four DVD set of this 12-part, 12-hour documentary film, you get essentially your dollars doubled by Melvin. So let's make this match. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. What's in this film series, The Untold History of the United States by Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick? Well, the first episode is World War II. It explores the birth of empire by focusing on FDR, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin. The second is Roosevelt, Truman, and Wallace, highlights from Harry Truman replacing Henry Wallace as Roosevelt's vice president during his fourth term. This dramatic shift in leadership propelled the U.S. toward empire building. Episode 3, The Bomb. So the strategies behind the U.S. atomic bombings of Japan are explored. Episode 4, these are all one-hour episodes. Episode 4, The Cold War, 1945 to 1950, which spells out specific month-by-month causes of the Cold War, 1-800-439-5732. Episode 5, The 50s, Eisenhower, The Bomb, and the Third World. Episode 6, JFK and the Bay of Pigs on the brink of total war during the Cuban Missile Crisis, early Vietnam. Episode 7, Johnson, Nixon, and Vietnam, Reversal of Fortune. Episode 8, Reagan, Gorbachev, and the Third World, The Rise of the Right. So Carter's dreams of change give way to Reagan's secret wars in Afghanistan and Central America. Gorbachev emerges. Episode 9, Bush and Clinton, Squandered Peace and New World Order. Episode 10, Bush and Obama, Age of Terror, Homeland Security, the worldwide global security state, Obama and the destiny of the American Empire, and then two more chapters, two more episodes on World War I, the Russian Revolution, and Woodrow Wilson, and 1920 to 1940, Franklin Roosevelt, Adolf Hitler, and Joseph Stalin. 12 hours, 12 episodes, not $1,200, but $175 one-year pledge to KPFA gets you all of this information. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can donate online at kpfa.org. There is so much in here, and what do some of the people who have watched this series say? They say that Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick have created a political history of the U.S. in the 20th century that tells us exactly how the U.S. became an empire through conscious decisions and how the struggle to maintain that empire will go on despite which political party holds office. It is a brilliant survey of the untold story. Another reviewer, a brave revisionist study which shatters many foreign policy myths. The Stone-Kuznick team grapples with the unsavory legacy of American militarism. And Howard Zinn, Daniel Ellsberg, says Howard Zinn would have loved this people's history of the American empire. It's compulsive reading. In this case of the book, brilliant, a masterpiece. And one more reviewer, Marjorie Cohn, who's no stranger to KPFA, says, Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick disabuse us of the popular notion that this country has always been a force for good in the world. They document the tragic consequences of U.S. imperialism, the commission of war crimes, and the decimation of civil liberties under the guise of the war on terror. We did make that match. Thank you so much to everybody who called in the last 4 minutes. I want to return now to more of both the film, The Untold History of the United States, and the discussion that Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick had at La Forme.
Instead of fighting for transparency, however, Obama became a far more effective manager of the national security state.
Like Bush, he repeatedly invoked the state secrets privilege in lawsuits involving torture, extraordinary rendition, and illegal NSA eavesdropping. He blocked habeas corpus rights for enemy combatants, preserved military commissions, and authorized without due process the killing of a U.S. citizen in Yemen accused of having ties to Al-Qaeda. Obama stunned civil libertarians when he took Bush-era investigations to the next level and began prosecuting government whistleblowers and reporters using the World War I-era Espionage Act. Only three cases have been brought in 92 years. Obama initiated six cases of dubious merit, most defendants claiming to have exposed unlawful activity in the government. Most prominent was Bradley Manning, an Army intelligence analyst in Iraq, who leaked over 260,000 classified diplomatic cables and war reports, as well as videos, distributed by WikiLeaks, a non-profit whistleblower media organization. These revelations of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and U.S. support for dictatorial regimes in the region proved to be a significant catalyst for the Arab Spring uprisings in Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, Libya, and Bahrain. Nonetheless, Obama's administration has severely impaired the operation of WikiLeaks and threatens to prosecute its co-founder. These actions send a clear message to all whistleblowers. Commit war crimes like Bush and Cheney and you walk free. Expose them and you risk careers and huge fines. Or, like Manning, you rot in jail.
Empires, we don't make these sacrifices for territory or for resources. We do it because it's right. Never forget that you are part of an unbroken line of heroes spanning two centuries. To your grandparents and parents who faced down fascism and communism, delivered justice to those who attacked us on 9/11.
Thus sanctioning, once again, Bush's lie about the connection of 9/11 to Iraq. The words were barely out of his mouth before Iraq was racked with a new series of deadly suicide bombings.
You know, politics don't make good bedfellows with Hollywood. They're very hard to make political movies. Most of the political movies have been to the right, frankly. The Rambo series is very successful, as was the Chuck Norris Missing in Action. A lot of the Zero Dark Thirty is, again, very supportive of our policy and of vigilantism. And I mean, even Argo gives a very a thrilling movie, gives a very pro-American point of view about Iran and doesn't really tell us the background. So, you know, that's what you're facing. There are some occasionally, I think, progressive movies that get through, like Syriana, I thought was interesting and very different, but it wasn't a big moneymaker. So it's very hard to get this made. All these movies. I could not probably make JFK today or Nixon, not even close. Bush was financed, the W movie was financed, 55% of that money came from Hong Kong. So nobody was interested in this country. We're not, Hollywood dissuades you from doing it. The most liberal section, the liberal era in Hollywood filmmaking was the 1930s and early 40s, when all these communists were working. And the guy who wrote Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Sidney Buckman, was a communist member of the party, and a lot of them were blacklisted and graylisted, and you know the story. So the most liberal period is gone, and I think the 80s were a disaster. Platoon was sort of and Born on the Fourth were started to go the other way. But by the 1990s, when Bush Sr. got in office, we had the whole rap about the greatest generation, World War II generation, neglecting, of course, the fact that, a lot of that generation had been pro-Nazi and fascist, did not want involvement in Spain, were willing, our businesses, our corporations, were doing business with Nazi Germany up to 1941, some beyond. Profits from many of those companies, Ford, GM, were repatriated after the war. We always had a very strong German, America has always had a strong fascist leaning. And it came back in. We took all the German scientists we could, and we took all the spy agency. We took this monster Gehlen, who into our embrace, Angleton and Dulles and all those scumbags, brought them in, and basically, you know, started an anti-Soviet, the old anti-Soviet propaganda machine recycled right after World War II, right away. So the films have not reflected that, frankly, and will never. I don't know how to get around it. Money means you have to make people happy, and you have to have a good... The problem with history, in American history, and I'm going to quickly get to a point, is that the kids don't like it, and they don't really care about it because it's so sanitized like a Disney movie. They take all the horror, juicy horror stuff out of history in school, and you don't get this kind of history, and the kids get bored because they know it's bull. American triumphalism. And it's American triumphalism in the movies, it's in the history books, it's all around us, it permeates our culture, it permeates the evening news. It's sad. It's sad that we're living in this warped vision of the world. It's a bubble. But I can't do much business there if I just talk like that and do like that. But I have to get my message out this way. This movie was not really been seen. It's a premium cable. Some people really like it, and I have to say some very big people, wonderful people, really appreciate it. But it's not really known yet, and I hope we'll get more and more adherence to it because Peter and I are out to make this a 10, 20-year journey, hopefully to get it into schools. We're trying in California.
Oliver Stone speaking with his co-writer, historian Peter Kuznick. He's an historian at American University. Speaking at Left Forum about the 12-part, 12-hour documentary set that they produced about U.S. empire in the 20th and 21st centuries. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain. This is listener-sponsored radio, and we've got a wonderful, extremely high-value thank you gift for those of you who want to pledge your make your pledge of financial support to KPFA this hour. For a $175 pledge to KPFA, you get not a one-hour documentary film or a three-hour documentary film or a 10-hour... You get 12 hours in 12 parts. It's a documentary film series in a handsome DVD box set, and it is the history of the U.S., the untold history of the United States. A $175 pledge. Break it down in installments, if you like, less than $15 a month. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And no, you don't have to pay all of your installments before you get this untold history of the United States sent to you. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. And we've been given a end of the hour match, which is from Anna and Gus in Napa, California. Beautiful Napa, California. I was just up there a couple weeks ago, and it's a conditional pledge of $800, so they will double everyone's dollars up to collectively the amount of $800, but we've only got 11 minutes to do it, and that means if you give $175 and you get this 12-hour documentary film series, you can double your contribution to KPFA. So we've got double high value going on here. The Untold History of the United States, it's a DVD box set, again, yours for a $175 pledge to KPFA. And you may be interested, a number of people during this fund drive have been very interested in the extremely high value combo pack of The Untold History on DVDs plus the Capitalism 6-part series. It's like a 5-hour series on capitalism for $1 a day to KPFA. Consider that as well. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And some of you like to read, so you can get the almost 800-page book, The Untold History of the United States, for a $100 pledge to KPFA. And there are various combinations. If you want the DVD box set plus the book, we'll give you a discounted rate for that. But the important thing is to call to get your money doubled and to say yes to this kind of information. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. This 12-hour film is not just a documentary. It is In my opinion, it's an adventure. It is a journey. It is a journey through the history of this nation. It is an authoritative but also subversive examination into U.S. history. It's suspenseful. It's gripping. A lot of this is on the edge of your seat stuff. And you heard Oliver Stone earlier this hour talk about the tyranny of now. That's what Untold History of the United States, that's what it pushes back against. And that's also what Against the Grain pushes back against. There's a lot of now stuff. There's a lot of the noise of everyday events, which are very important. But we like to step back, and certainly the Untold History of the U.S. is an incredible effort at stepping back and looking at the broad sweep of U.S. history. How did we get here? What happened such that militarism and empire and a very destructive U.S. foreign policy are so much a part of the way the U.S. has operated and does operate? 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. And I'll tell you, you know, our fundraising on this hour, in this time slot, has been a little bit down this fund drive. So we would love it if you could pick us up, and maybe we pick you up sometimes. Maybe we give you insights that surprise you, that provoke you, that educate you, that inform you, that make you want to go deeper. Maybe you go to our archives on kpfa.org. Maybe you listen via kpfa.org. So we would like you to think about giving back and really fueling and generating some momentum for this program. Because when you make a pledge this hour, it's kind of a vote for Against the Grain. Management sees it. Other people around the station see it. It's a way of letting everybody around here know that you value this particular program and the kind of programming that Sasha Lilly and I give you 3 days a week. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. As I said earlier, often, a one-hour or an 80-minute documentary film is available as a thank you gift for a $100 pledge of support. Well, this is not an hour and 20-minute documentary film. This is a 12-hour documentary film series, and we are asking for just a $175 pledge to KPFA. Some people have given $25 this hour, and that makes them a voting KPFA member. And we would appreciate any amount that you could come through for us right now. There are thank you gifts for amounts of money less than $175. Just call the phone volunteers. We've got a room full of them. They're ready to take your call. They'll give you all the information. They'll go through the various choices. Certainly a popular one this hour has been the DVD box set of The Untold History of the United States, a $175 one-year pledge to KPFA, less than $15 a month. And think about this. $15 a month, I mean, that's like going to see a movie at a theater and getting maybe a little refreshment. I haven't been to a theater for a while. And so you get essentially 12 films that you could watch every month of the year. And so it's a wash. It's just like you're going to the movie theater once a year, once a month for a whole year. You get 12 films for that amount. And here you get 12 films, 12 standalone parts. You can watch these in installments. Plus you get KPFA. Plus you get the knowledge that you're supporting KPFA and this radio program. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And, you know, at this point, dismantling the myths of the right, stripping away the triumphalism that characterizes most discussions of U.S. power in the mainstream media, is especially important because we know what's happening on the Republican side. We know what's happening on the right. We know what's happening on the moderate left. And many of these myths need to be stripped away. And this is the way to do it. This is the information in these 12 episodes that will help you understand what this nation has done, is doing, and what context all of the daily noise that we get on all the news channels. Oh my gosh, there's such a proliferation of news, and you know, you get the news feeds, and you're watching TV, and they're telling you something, but they're also showing you something, and there's a little ticker at the bottom. There's all this stuff that's being pounded into our brains every day. This gives you the crucial context for understanding our history, and it asks questions like, did history have to turn out the way it did? Were there other ways that the course of history could have gone? 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Our most popular thank you gifts thus far this hour, we've got 4 minutes left, have been the DVD box set of The Untold History of the United States for a $175 pledge. But the other one is this combo pack of both the six-part Capitalism series, that's a five-hour documentary film series, plus The Untold History of the United States. That's like 17 hours of information, 18 episodes, and not a book, not a CD. This is film. This is stuff you watch and you can really engage with. That's a dollar a day to KPFA. Capitalism, the six-part series, plus The Untold History, the 12-part series, dollar a day to KPFA. Maybe KPFA is worth a dollar a day to you. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Again, the 12 episodes in this, The Untold History of the United States, World War II, Roosevelt, Truman, and Henry Wallace, the bomb, the Cold War, 1945 to 1950, the 50s, Eisenhower, the bomb, and the Third World, JFK to the brink, Johnson, Nixon, and Vietnam, Reagan, Gorbachev, and the Third World, Bush and Clinton, Bush and Obama. And then there are two sort of prequel episodes, World War One, the Russian Revolution, and Woodrow Wilson, and FDR, Adolf Hitler, and Joseph Stalin. And one reviewer said, Kuznick and Stone's Untold History is the most important historical narrative of this century. This is the kind of stuff people say about this film series and this book. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Gar Alperovitz, who's been on this program, says it's time for serious people to confront rather than avoid or attempt to denigrate the profound challenges raised by Stone and Kuznick. They are asking and answering all the right questions. And another reviewer said, the immense contribution of The Untold History of the U.S. is to shatter the conventional wisdom, challenging readers and viewers to reconceptualize the American role in the world. Everyone who takes in this untold history will learn something new and be compelled to examine long-held assumptions. For students of U.S. history, and I think we're all students of U.S. history, and we sort of need to be, this is an invaluable work. And Bruce Cummings, who is a prominent scholar, said, a fascinating and provocative work. This courageous and clear-minded account of American history and the foundations of the American empire is a milestone. 1-800-439-5732. Get all 12 parts, all 12 hours of The Untold History of the U.S. by Oliver Stone. And think about multitasking it, which means you can watch it, and then you can share it, maybe watch it with friends, and then you can give it to a young person and blow their mind and give them a political head start, perhaps the political head start you wish you had in your evolution as a social and political and cultural thinker, as a citizen, as a person engaged with the issues of the world. Or maybe give this to a library. So much you could do both personally and community-wide with this film series. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. It's not too late to call, and we are so happy to be able to offer you all this information, all this insight on a 12-part, 12-hour documentary film series. We did make that match. Thank you to everybody who's called. Thanks to Erica Bridgman. Thanks to Sasha. Thanks to everybody who's called. You can still keep calling and contribute.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.